cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where the old darkest heart am long to go. There's where I labored so hard, poor old massa, day after day in the field of yellow corn.
70 years after seven black men were executed in Virginia for the rape of a white woman, Governor Ralph Northam has pardoned them posthumously. They're known as the Martinsville Seven. Our Jake Burns spoke to their families today about why bringing national exposure to this case is so important to them. Jake?
Well, most of you at home probably have not heard these names before. That's Frank Hairston Jr., Booker Milner, Francis DeSales Grayson, Howard Lee Hairston, James Luther Hairston, Joe Henry Hampton, and John Claiborne Taylor. For their families, this day is about those seven.
I couldn't help from crying when I seen my brother's face.
A scheduled rally for justice for the men known as the Martinsville Seven.
I cried about it. I prayed about it that, you know, that the families will receive that closure. And today is history.
Morphed into a celebration.
They will say, like James Brown said, get on the good foot. Good God. Okay? We made it.
Back in 1951, these seven black men from Martinsville all put to death for the alleged rape of a white woman. The mass execution was the largest for rape in U.S. history, a sentencing first handed down by an all-white jury just 8 days after the incident.
These men were executed because they were black.
In a surprise to the families and advocates, Governor Northam signing posthumous pardons for the Martinsville Seven, saying evidence shows they weren't given due process and their sentence was racially biased.
Thank you, Lord.
This reaction from James Grayson, the son of Francis DeSales Grayson, now pardoned 70 years after the state put him to death.
As we sit here in 2021 and think about, you know, what happened, the rapid trials, the trials by juries that were all white men, it was wrong. I think we all, again, as a society, need to work together to do right for the Commonwealth.
And I want you all to put this on the front page of a national newspaper. I want to see this on Oprah. I want to see this on MSNBC, CNN. I want the world to know about the Martinsville Seven.
A moment of jubilance for seven families who quickly point out the thousands of other black families who won't feel this.
If we band together and work together and fight together, we can acquire the end that we seek, because the Martinsville Seven is just one story.
Efforts are underway to memorialize this case and its significance in Martinsville. Advocates hoping through either a museum or some other forum they can find a way to talk about this history and what it means.
Who is your favorite scientist?
Well, I will balk at answering that. I don't really have a favorite scientist, per se. But I will say that I almost always go out of my way to try to talk about George Washington Carver. And I'll tell you why. I don't know if I mentioned this on your last show or not, Gus. I probably did, but it bears repeating. George Washington Carver was probably one of the greatest scientific minds of modern times. They have given us Newton, and they've given us Einstein, and they give us Stephen Hawking. What he did three things in his career, each of which would easily merit him a Nobel Prize had he done nothing else. The first thing Carver did, first let me tell you about his history. So Carver is about 4 years old, and his family was stolen. They were slaves. They were enslaved. And they were stolen by slave robbers. Everybody was killed except for Carver. And slave catchers actually recovered him. Now, if you've read anything about slave robbers and slave catchers, these are two groups of people that the slave don't want to see because they're completely backwards, more so than the slave master himself, and very abusive. And so we don't really know fully what happened to Carver when he was in the hands of the slave robber or the slave catcher, but he did survive. And they took him back to the plantation, so he lived his life. He wasn't able to do any work after whatever torture they put him through, any field work, so he pretty much worked around the house.
This episode is all about the famous Missourian and visionary, George Washington Carver. Today we're going to debunk some of the myths and get to know the man. Dr. George Washington Carver went far beyond peanuts. I'm sure that you have, well, actually, I'm going to ask you, what do you know about George Washington Carver?
Peanuts. I mean, literally, that's what I know about him. And we were all handed some coloring sheet in school with him standing there holding peanuts. So I think my memory of him was he was some sort of businessman and obviously was a peanut farmer.
We're going to take time to appreciate this often overlooked and sometimes misunderstood man. To help us get there, here's a recording of him from 1939, so you can just kind of hear what he sounded like and get an idea of who George Washington Carver was.
Dr. Carver, do you consider yourself a chemist?
We have to be very careful lest the ego comes in. A person that can bake a reasonably good cake or a reasonably good pan of biscuit can't go out and put up a shingle and say that they are good cooks. But they simply use the kettle or pan as a means to carry out the end. So I simply use the chemical laboratory to find certain things that I'm looking for.
I will say this, listening to his voice, I'm struck by the tone and the cadence of it. He really has a very unique way of speaking, and it's lilting. It's almost like music.
Sometimes it is wise not to look for too much appreciation. The main thing is to be sure you're right and go ahead, regardless of whether people appreciate it or whether they don't, because in time, they will appreciate it.
George became commonly known for the peanut because he made over 300 different uses for it. He broke the plan completely down and then found ways to rebuild it and reuse it. We're going to start with foods that he made with peanuts. We've got salted peanuts, peanut butter, regular peanut butter flour, butter rum peanut milk, pancake flour, chocolate-coated peanuts, peanut butter cookies, which I thought were delicious. Me and my kids made one of the recipes from his bulletin just the other day.
For this recipe, we're supposed to cream butter and sugar, add eggs well beaten, then we add milk and flour, flour to taste, vanilla, and the peanuts last. Drop one spoonful to the cooking in well-greased pans.
Alright, so now we've got our cookie dough made. Drop little spoonfuls onto our cookie sheets and let them bake. And then we'll do a taste test. Not too bad.
Dry.
A little dry. A little dry. But, I mean, for a 1930s recipe, not bad. Yeah.
The cookies were great, although very healthy. And not gonna lie, my puppy Oliver loves them as his new favorite dog treats. George Washington Carver made chop suey sauce with peanuts, Worcestershire sauce, mock chicken, mock veal cutlets, cream cheese, pimento cheese, a nut sage cheese, all using peanuts.
Wait, so all the vegan things that we have today,
yes,
is what you're telling me he created?
With peanuts.
With peanuts, right, which is like the cashew cheese that we have today, he just made peanut cheese.
Which is so inspiring for the 1920s.
And peanut protein or peanut meat.
Yes, his little mock veal with...
Mock veal? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he's got a lot of things. And then
he's the godfather of vegetarian and vegan cuisine.
Yes. And then he made laundry soap, a sweeping compound for your floors, which cleaned at the same time as getting the dirt up. He had medicines, rubbing oil, iron tonic, an emulsion for bronchitis. He also had some laxatives in there and a little goiter treatment.
I felt that we did not know enough about the efficacy of oils in the art of healing, so I started out to find as far as possible the value of some of these oils.
And I think one of the most important things to remember is he used peanuts. He recommended it as a crop because peanuts are good for the soil. They pull nitrogen out of the air and they put it into the soil. And he did this about 1920s, and it ended up being his lasting legacy and kind of overshadowed everything else that he had done in his life.
Okay, so more than peanuts, what is it that we need to know about him?
Well, I'll take you from the beginning. George Washington Carver was born enslaved around 1864. He lived on a farm owned by Moses and Susan Carver in Diamond, Missouri. Soon after he was born, he and his mother were kidnapped and taken to Arkansas. They eventually found Carver, but they never found his mother. So he returned to the Carver's farm. But when he returned, he was sick with whooping cough. So Moses and Susan Carver took him and his brother under their wing, and as a child, being orphaned and sickly, he spent a lot of time in the forest. He never really had to work the fields because it was just a little too hard on him. But there is where he learned and to love the wonders of nature. So he found himself really in those moments of being alone in the solace, tranquility, and the just quietness of nature. And that had a huge impact on him and really solidified his relationship with God. He felt God all around him and felt like the... This is going to sound a little crazy, but he felt like all of the rocks and trees and leaves and everything that were around him were speaking to him. So he took that as a way to spike his curiosity, and it made him want to know more. At nearly 12 years old, George decides he wants to get an education. Alone and on foot, he walks about 10 miles from Diamond, Missouri to Neosho, Missouri. He really wanted to start his own path to freedom. And there in Neosho, he met a free black couple, Andrew and Mariah Watkins. Mariah was a midwife, and she had tons of knowledge of plants and their healing powers. She taught George and stressed the importance of using his talents to empower his people. Eventually, he got accepted to Highland College in Highland, Kansas. But when he arrived and they saw he was African American, they turned him away. So instead, George eventually made his way to Iowa. He was accepted to Simpson College, where he discovered that he wanted to be an artist, and that he was an amazing artist. There, he really thrived, and eventually, he got really into horticulture. George became the first black student to get his master's at Iowa State University, and the first black faculty member ever at the school.
What an incredible story. Seriously, for a small black child in Missouri to find his way kind of time and time again after... and. You know, after things are kind of taken away from him, you know, he finds new people find him and take him in.
Yes. I like to think of that as like Missouri spirit, you know, to
right.
Just kind of be that neighbor, be that person to be there and help someone and lend a helping hand. I think that
absolutely
that makes me really proud.
It's not like George Washington Carver came out of nowhere, right? This is part of, you know, the whole community's move forward.
Rafia Zoffer is a professor at Washington State University.
It's like the expression, right? Making a way out of no way.
She wrote a wonderful book that I got at the beginning of the summer called Recipes for Respect, African American Meals and Meanings. And she is really good at explaining foodways. Do you know what foodways are, Jenny?
I don't.
So foodways is kind of where culture and history collide.
American foodways are African American, they're European, and they're Native American. And people often don't realize. I mean, that is the greatness of the United States.
So she focuses on that and preserving foodways, which is what she believed that that George Washington Carver did. He was trying to preserve foods and ways of making food and getting food for future farmers, to give them kind of a roadmap of how to be regenerative farmers in their practices.
You know, it's like passing the torch. I mean, Carver's so, he is so underrated. And of course, I was one of like all those little school children who knew about, you know, like, oh, George Washington Carver invented peanut butter.
George Washington Carver did not invent peanut butter. That is one of the myths. He made it, but he did not invent it. Canadian chemist Marcellus Gilmore Edson did. Rafia Zafer has a beautiful way of highlighting Black history and really given a voice to the food movement that sometimes gets forgotten or misunderstood.
The scales fell from my eyes. More than peanuts, I thought.
George Washington Carver, we should start with the myths, because he's so much more than the myths that we hear.
Yes. Yes, he is. You know, and that's, you know, this is true of so many people. I mean, who immediately comes to mind? Rosa Parks, right? Rosa Parks, she was tired and she sat down because it was the last straw. Forgetting that there had been years of social activism on her part, years of pushing for civil rights. But the soundbite, the thing, the little image and the story that kids get and then passes on to the elders is that, you know, she was just working hard and, you know, she just couldn't take it anymore. No, it was part of a life struggle. And Carver is like that. So many people who are not famous in the way that Carver is or famous in the way that Parks were doing the same kind of thing, the daily struggles that are not, you know, put up in lights, that are not memorialized either in histories or in children's books. He gave up a job at Iowa State and he said, "My people are calling me." He had a mission.
His career led him to increased respect for overall Black intellect and scientific prowess. So his life constituted its own, if indirect, debunking of white supremacy. So when he was getting into circles and getting into fields of agriculture that you didn't see a lot of Black professors in. He was actually the only African-American in the country that had a degree in agriculture at the time Booker T. Washington came looking for him to go teach at Tuskegee.
And it's interesting because in some ways he really didn't grow up like in a small Black town, right? He was not at a big, wasn't raised on a game plantation in like Georgia or Louisiana where he'd be like tons of Black folks around him. He really had the life of a fairly isolated African-American person who was enslaved, right? This small, like maybe there were only two or three people on a farm. So it's not like there wasn't Blackness all around him, but he didn't have necessarily, as a young person, other than his brother, have that sort of web, right? That matrix. But he knew it was there, and he knew how important it was, how fundamental it was.
In 1896, Booker T. Washington sent George a letter offering him a job at Tuskegee University in Alabama, which had just been founded. Booker T. Washington needed to create an agriculture department, so he sent him a letter asking him to come and teach at the school, and Carver wrote back to Booker T. Washington and said, "It has always been one ideal of my life to be the greatest good to the greatest number of my people possible, and to this end, I have been preparing myself for this moment for years, feeling as I do that this education is the key to unlocking the golden door of freedom to our people." George remained at Tuskegee for the next 47 years until his death.
He needed to be there. If Tuskegee was a place where his people could get an education, he struggled to get an education. So that's why Tuskegee was so important to him, and also that model of Black self-sufficiency that Booker T. Washington was preaching.
He actually came up with a wagon. It was called the Jessup Wagon, and he would take it to small towns and fairs and different festivals, and on the actual wagon, he would have different foods to show them different hands-on techniques for farming and ways to preserve the food that they were growing. So he took the show on the road, which was pretty unheard of for that time period.
He was ahead of everybody.
The thing that I loved about the Jessup Wagon is that it was going to places where sharecroppers weren't getting a lot of attention. And he was able to go and really just educate them and help give them a leg up using their own land so that they could make it through
the right. winters or whatever seasons they needed to without having to rely on anyone else.
Right. It's a company store, right? If you're just the old places where you can get stuff is, you know, owned by rapacious whites, you know, or even not too rapacious, and they'll overcharge any sharecropper, you know, white, black, or if there were any Native American, you know, they were just going to overcharge people, right? That's kind of what people did.
Yeah. And it was hot. It was so hot. It was like 95, 100 degrees in the shade. The wind never blew.
And they say that New Orleans has humidity down there, which kind of cools us off. That's bullshit. It was death heat.
Inside the convention center was so stifling hot, people tried to stay outside.
Hot as hell, 100-something degrees.
It's hot.
It was very, very hot at that time. It was 97, 98 degrees.
It was hot.
The heat radiating off of the highway at night was intensely hot.
It's hot as hell.
That was the worst summer. I mean, that heat was ridiculous.
Man, hot as heck in here.
It was beyond Africa heat. If Africa heat was anything like that, like I said before, and I'll say it again, they keep saying go back to Africa. Hell no.
We started the show talking about hurricane relief for the Gulf Coast. Science has proven that climate change is making hurricanes more intense and more frequent, and that it's having a similar effect on wildfires and excessive heat. Now, this month, the Italian island of Sicily may have registered the hottest temperature ever in Europe. The mercury reached 119 degrees, and temperatures got even hotter closer to home earlier this summer when a heat dome settled over the Pacific Northwest. Meanwhile, a new report shows that climate change could quadruple the likelihood that outdoor workers in the U.S. are exposed to deadly heat, which would jeopardize not only their livelihoods but their lives. Reset sustainability contributor Karen Weigert joins us now to talk about urban heat and how discriminatory policies like redlining are linked to higher rates of heat-related illnesses for people in marginalized communities. Karen once served as chief sustainability officer for the city of Chicago, and she's currently executive vice president at Slipstream, a clean energy innovation nonprofit. Hi, Karen. Welcome back.
Hey, Sasha. Good to be here.
Karen, though the temperatures are slightly milder now, I guess we could say, you know, Chicago's been really, really hot. But have other places been even hotter?
You know, many, many places have been hot, definitely hot. In fact, July was the hottest month ever recorded by NOAA. Yeah. So, you know, you gave those examples of Italy and then Portland. We've seen multiple cases of really, really high heat, and not just a day, but heat waves. But it all comes to a point if you think about the example, the highest land temperature ever recorded happened this year in California, Death Valley.
Wow. So how do these extremes fit into the bigger picture of global warming?
Unfortunately, they do fit. So there is this trend of warming overall, and the stats are just all there, unfortunately. We've had 19 of the 20th warmest years since 2001. The hottest decade was 2011 to 2020. The hottest year was last year. So we have this base of warming. And when you have heat waves, you're now starting from a base that's already warmer. So they're all a little bit more extreme, in addition to we're having more and more of those incidents. And when you think about the big picture, often you hear folks talk about we're looking at trying to address climate and stay below that 1.5 degrees of warming goal. That's Celsius. If you put it in Fahrenheit, we've already passed 1.5 degrees.
Right.
So we often think Fahrenheit instead of Celsius. We're already seeing that kind of warming.
I know it's one thing to talk about how hot it is. Obviously, we're feeling it in places that we live. But how dangerous has this heat been, Karen, both here and elsewhere?
Yeah, heat's extremely dangerous. And I appreciate you asking the question. Chicago obviously has experienced this in the most devastating and profound wave with the heat wave back in 1995 with multiple days of heat, you know, with over 700 people killed. But this is happening in multiple places. In fact, if you look at the largest weather-related disaster in the U.S., it actually is heat consistently. And so we're seeing those heat waves, and we're not just seeing them in the U.S., but we're seeing that, you know, if you just add a heat wave on top of a place that's already 1 degree warmer than it used to be, back to those trends we were just talking about, it increases the risk of dying by 2.5%. So there's a multiplier there. It's really scary.
How close are we to getting back to 1995? Because that's scary.
You know, that is.
And I think we've seen similar things in other places. I think that heat wave, that dome that existed over the Pacific Northwest and in Canada, that was incredibly unusual. And that's a place where homes don't typically have air conditioning.
Canada saw its highest temperature on record yesterday.
You'll only find it hotter in Kuwait and Iraq. Even Death Valley is cooler today than some parts of British Columbia. Carolina and her five-month-old baby in northern Vancouver didn't sleep a wink last night.
So we're spending like $300 to sleep in a hotel tonight and have the baby and the dog in a room with air conditioning.
And so when you're in those moments of extreme heat, you need to cool, and there are multiple ways to think about that. But having that air conditioning and being able to afford that air conditioning really matters. You know, gratefully, we haven't seen exactly that kind of heat in Chicago, but the trends are towards more heat.
So sometimes it feels hotter in some parts of the city than others. Why is that?
Yeah, it feels that way because it actually is hotter in some parts of the city.
Thought I was losing my mind.
it's not you. It's actually what's around you. It's the urban heat island. And so in cities, the surfaces that are dark will absorb heat. So you'll absorb the solar radiation during the day. And so you feel that. And at night, then that comes back out. And so some places don't even cool as much at night. And so you have that dark infrastructure. And then in many places in our city, you don't have a lot of trees. And so the trees provide, you know, that respite even in that moment when you can get that shade. But they also provide some cooling from the leaf structure. And so it is the case that parts of cities are actually hotter. And they're often places that are additionally near highways or near factories that are creating essentially waste heat that then adds to what the local infrastructure has already caused.
Mm. This disproportionate heat pattern, does that happen in many cities?
It does. It absolutely does. There are multiple cities actually that are reporting on this. So they will talk about temperature differentials in different neighborhoods in their cities. And so you can certainly see it that way. What's particularly profound is that there's now been analysis that looks at why and where. And in over 100 cities, the analysis showed that there are links historically to redlining. So neighborhoods that did not receive investment, where there were discriminatory lending policies based on race typically, you're still feeling that effect now. Those areas often have less tree cover. And so in city after city after city, those historical redlining maps are translating into hotter places for people to live right now. And there are even examples where some of the hottest zip codes will lead to the highest emergency-related visits in those heat days.
Wow. That is Karen Weigert. If you're just tuning in, she is Reset's sustainability expert and executive vice president of Slipstream. Karen also served as the City of Chicago's chief sustainability officer. Karen, I want to zoom out just a little bit and take this global. What else is happening around the world?
Well, those heat trends are certainly global. The IPCC recently put out a report that showed that changes in the Earth's climate are happening in every region around the world, and that warming over land is actually higher than the global average. So this is happening in every corner of the Earth. And then if you look at questions about where, it's often interesting to look at where is population growth. And a lot of the global population growth is happening in places that are warmer to begin with. So places like India or Africa. And so you have population growth. People are going to need places to live. And you have heat that is already high and rising. So we're going to have a huge air conditioning challenge so that growing populations ideally can be cool. But right now that puts you in a cycle of air conditioning typically. And that can be a large source of carbon. Mm-hmm. So there are efforts there. There's a Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol, which is working to address the climate impacts of coolants in air conditioning. There's a lot of work to do there because globally more and more people are going to need to be cooled.
So, Karen, you know, let's bring it back to Illinois for just a moment. We sit on one of the largest bodies of fresh water in the world. And being from Toronto, I know how the Great Lakes can tinker with the weather. So how does the lake relate to this heat?
Well, first of all, lucky us, and thank you to the many people who built these cities so that we get the privilege of living in places like Chicago and throughout the Great Lakes. Because you're absolutely right. The Great Lakes and our proximity to the Great Lakes do result in cooler summers and milder winters. And so we do benefit from that in addition to the many other ways that we benefit from access to a lake and to cooling and actually things like swimming on a hot summer day. But there are little pieces of data that are troubling that are emerging. And there was some recent data this summer on temperatures deep, deep down in Lake Michigan. We're talking 500 feet down. And they looked at many, many years and they are seeing small elements of warming even that deep. So we're certainly benefiting from the Great Lakes now, but we have to keep our eye on what's happening.
So what are cities doing exactly to address heat inequity and other heat issues?
There's a lot that cities can do. We talked a little bit earlier about trees and some of the benefits of trees. And in the right places, a tree can just fundamentally reduce a home's energy cost by up to 25% in significant numbers. And DOE has also looked at the benefit of trees across the U.S. from air pollution removal, even to carbon sequestration, so to capturing carbon. And it's really significant. So one of the places that cities can look is absolutely trees. And we actually heard from Daniela Pereira, the Vice President of Community Conservation from Openlands, when she joined us on the show on this very topic.
The more tree canopy we have, the less urban heat island. And urban heat island really comes about because we tend to have a lot more pavement, a lot more buildings in cities, and that absorbs the sun's energy and then releases it at heat. And it releases it at heat at night when things usually should cool off. One study recently says that in the United States, extreme heat events cause more deaths annually than all other extreme weather events combined.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And if you tie that then to what's possible, so Chicago is now looking at a new urban forestry ordinance. That's really important. We have to figure out how that's actually going to be implemented and what it can do. But the data on the tree cover in the Chicago metro region actually shows that it increased over the last decade, but not in the city of Chicago. And so we really have some things to look at there. And other cities are starting to create roles. Miami, in fact, has a new role of a chief heat officer. Athens, Greece has done the same thing.
Wow.
Because they're really looking at that question and having to think holistically about how do they protect their residents from this real challenge of heat.
A chief heat officer, a CHO. Interesting. I want to talk more about the chain effects here. How does extreme heat impact the economy?
You know, Miami has the first chief heat officer, and one of the things that she's talked about is the impact on outdoor workers. And so many of us, you know, we're able to have this conversation indoors, but many folks work outdoors, and that's increasingly dangerous. So there's a real impact directly there when you just think about the course of work during a day. You know, then there are implications for related industries. So how will heat continue to impact agriculture? We're seeing changes in planting times. We're seeing also changes in precipitation. So the impacts actually start to thread through the economy. And when the Chicago region recently looked at a new climate plan, they identified the two largest threats as flooding and heat.
So what can we do right now, Karen, to fix this? Because this is pretty urgent. Tell us the low-hanging fruit in policy, maybe, or even just in our own homes and neighborhoods that we can cling to.
Yeah. So the first thing is, what do you do when it's hot right now? So when it's hot right now, there are what are called passive cooling opportunities. So it's ways where you don't have to buy anything new, but to keep your place cooler. So it's things like blocking your windows so that the sun and the heat doesn't come through. The windows are actually a way that heat moves really easily inside. There are ways then, you know, at night to think about opening your windows to get the cooler night air into your home, and then to open windows if you have a two floor at the top so that hot air goes out. So that's something that can work for everyone in terms of just in that moment. And that can work at pretty high temperatures to keep it lower. Then you get into those bigger questions about investments and where are the changes. And this can be done by individuals, but this is also where you really need policy to scale to create opportunities for everyone. So it's things like having trees near your home to block that sun and to also create that cooling, to potentially having roofs. Chicago has a lot of green roofs. They're fantastic for cooling, also for stormwater capture, which is another challenge, and for biodiversity even. But roofs can also be white, and Chicago has actually worked pretty hard on that too. So how can we keep our buildings cooler? But then we also have to have cooling centers, places that folks can go on those days that are very, very hot if their home doesn't afford them the opportunity to be cool there. That's a way to reach multiple people. And then over time, we have to make sure that more and more homes are efficient and that they can stay cool, but also be affordable while they stay cool. So there's a critical lens there, both from an individual all the way up then to policy so that it's available to everyone.
That is Karen Weigert. She is Reset's sustainability contributor. Karen, thank you so much. As always, I learn so much from you.
It's a pleasure to join you.
The Karnofsky Building is where Armstrong worked as a child for the Karnofsky family. They were the ones to encourage him to pursue music. And while we can never predict exactly what weather events will take from us, we can try to prepare. And in this instance, New Orleans was not prepared to lose the Karnofsky Building. I wanted to get a sense of how big a loss this was by talking with another native son of New Orleans, actor Wendell Pierce. Now, you probably know Pierce from Jack Ryan, or maybe his iconic Bunk Moreland role in The Wire. But if you're from New Orleans, what you truly remember is Wendell Pierce as Antoine Baptiste in HBO's Tremé.
You'd have taken Jefferson Highway to Magazine to get into town like I told you. It would have been cheaper.
You're killing me, dog. 28 on the meat.
I'm good for it, man. Just pick me up at 2 right here, baby. Take me home.
What I didn't expect to hear was how harrowing the experience of getting his own father, who's 96 years old, to safety during Ida was. Pierce had to watch the storm unfold from an ocean away due to his work.
I am in Athens, Greece right now working, shooting Jack Ryan. Saw the storm coming. We saw how urgent it was to evacuate. I didn't want to take any chances. My father was 80 during Katrina, and he's 96 now.
Wow.
He's at home still. We rebuilt the home that we rebuilt after Katrina, and he's under 24-hour care. So I coordinated 2 caretakers to go with him in his wheelchair accessible van and a follow car. And one of the caretakers, I said, bring your family, her husband and 3 children. And they started the trek to Houston. It took them 12 and a half hours. We had a medical emergency with one of the children on that Friday. I called ahead and said, we're going to be delayed because they have to have a medical procedure. And we'll get there Saturday morning. Got there Saturday night. That's how long it took.
Yeah.
When they arrived, their rooms were given away. It's now 1 o'clock in the morning. I asked to speak to the night manager or the night auditor, whatever his position is. I was on a speakerphone, and he said he refused to speak to me. I said, I coordinated this entire trip. I've paid for this entire trip. How can you give the rooms away? And they gave the rooms away. So now I'm stuck. You know, we're in Houston. There's no rooms because everybody from New Orleans has evacuated there. My father has been in his wheelchair on the road for 12 and a half hours. I know I have to really take care of his health because it's fragile. We then immediately start getting on the phones, trying to find some place to stay. And that night clerk then said, get out. You can't stay here, to my caretakers. And I said, we are trying to get rooms. You gave our rooms away. We called. He said, if you don't leave this lobby, I'm going to call security. And I was furious. So I told my caretakers, we were all getting a little upset then. I said, no, stay calm. Go outside. He said he wants us to leave. And we still have to find rooms. So then they went outside in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. There, my father strapped into his wheelchair accessible van. The 3 kids are sleeping in the backseat of the other car. We're all on the telephones trying to find rooms in the middle of the night. It's now around 2 a.m. He then comes down and says, if you don't leave the parking lot, I'm going to call the police and have your vehicles towed. At this point, I'm furious. But I know the one thing I have to do is get my father somewhere so he can rest, so his health won't be endangered. I've been living all year in the Four Seasons in Budapest. I called them, literally, on the other side of the earth. They said, contact our hotel in Houston. We have one there. Contacted them. They gave us 3 rooms almost immediately. I said, leave that parking lot now. And I saw a wonderful story this morning of how this World War II veteran was saved in St. John Parish and how he was treated and taken out and the flag was given to him and all of that. And I thought about my father, how he was treated, another World War II veteran, as he arrived at 2 a.m. in Houston, like Mary and Joseph. There's no room in the inn. Forget you. And not only that, I will threaten you by calling authorities on you and now threaten you to get off my property.
You know, part of what's happened here is because the levees held, because there aren't spectacular images to show of our family members and our neighbors and our friends on the roofs of their home awaiting rescue, folks might think that, oh, well, all you had to do was evacuate. Like, how hard is that? And
I feel like your story was such an important reminder that that question of just evacuate, just go, it's not that simple. And you're in a circumstance where you have resources. You're Wendell Pierce. You can make that phone call.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I thought about that. You know, I said, you know, and people attacked me on social media saying, you know, who are you to call out some night clerk? And I'm like, it doesn't matter who I am. It's how people are treated. And I was only thinking about all the people that were treated that way that didn't have the resources. How many people didn't have the platform that I have on social media to expose the way that's probably how difficult the evacuation could be for so many people. 12 and a half hours on the road and to be greeted like that. But then just to have the difficulty of finding rooms and having the resources to now be in those rooms and going, are we going to stay for 2 days or 2 weeks or now 2 months?
Which, of course, in so many ways brings us back to the experience 16 years ago. And particularly, you know, I think as I was realizing that your father was trying to get into a hotel in Houston, and we remember how so many people who were fleeing Katrina, who went to Houston, also did not find a warm welcome from the public policy there. Can you talk to us a little bit about the work that you've really been doing over the past 16 years? Maybe start with Pontchartrain Park.
I grew up in a wonderful neighborhood of Pontchartrain Park, which grew out of the civil rights movement. It was something ugly, actually, separate but equal, as we turned something ugly into something beautiful, and it became an incubator for Black talent. But it was a neighborhood that was very important to the evolution of New Orleans and the civil rights movement. And it was totally destroyed during Katrina. And I put out a call to action to my generation, the Joshua generation, who have gone out in the world and become successful men and women, to come back and reestablish the neighborhood. And that's what we did. We rebuilt the neighborhood brick by brick, block by block, house by house. We reconstituted the Pontchartrain Park Neighborhood Association. Major League Baseball came to the community and rebuilt Barrow Stadium and made it an urban youth academy for their training program. Southern University at New Orleans has returned, and we put together our own development and did 40 homes. So leaving at this time, we were a little anxious to see that all the work that has been done over the 16 years would hold. And so far, so good when it comes to the levees.
So not everything survived, Ida. Do you want to talk a little bit about the destruction of this legendary jazz landmark?
You know, for years we've been advocating, cultural leaders in New Orleans have been advocating for the city to really honor our iconic landmarks and iconic figures being the birthplace of jazz. Actually, jazz is a national park. Literally, the art form is a national park, just like the Grand Canyon. And most people in New Orleans don't even know that. And one of the landmarks was on the most famous block of jazz, where the creation of jazz, literally, you can stand on its mark. And that was the Karnofsky Grocery Store and Pawn Shop. Forgive the pronunciation, but the family was caretakers and employers of a little jazz icon and protege by the name of Louis Armstrong. It was where he worked. Next to that shop is hopefully, when I go back, it's still there, is the Eagle Saloon. And at the Eagle Saloon, the real founders of the music, the inventors of jazz, Jelly Roll Morton, Kid Ory, Buddy Bolden, they all played there. On the other side of that pawn shop and down that street, a couple of addresses is the Iroquois Theater, where when the music then started to be popularized, people really wanted to see it. It became one of the music halls at the very beginning of the onset of this great American iconic art form of jazz. And those three buildings are on the National Register of Historic Places. And I'm 58 years old in December, and they have never been renovated and never been restored and never held up to the level that they deserve. And one of them was lost in Ida. And I hope that this is a lesson that we'd learn as New Orleanians, as the leadership goes back, as cultural bearers, we must demand that these places be restored, be held up. They're on the National Register of Historic Places. They're the only reason they haven't been torn down is because they're protected by that designation. But yet we have procrastinated and been apathetic about these icons. So we wonder if it's if that indifference is going to continue on. And it just broke my heart when I saw the images of it gone. And when you see that image, there was the one sort of nod to the historic nature of that plot of land was a mural of the only photograph of Buddy Bolden in an early band. Hmm. Once in New Orleans, the saying said, right next to it, it was a beautiful mural. It was actually hopeful that they might even actually restore the buildings that it was honoring next to them. And now the images, that mural is destroyed too. It went down with the building and it's gone. It's decayed. It's crumbled. But yet there's still the saying next to it, once in New Orleans. The irony of that and the irony of that image should shake us to our core and realize that we have to bring back and honor the people that created this great, great American art form, jazz.
No electricity, no water, no air conditioning, and a shortage of gasoline. That is what hundreds of thousands of residents of southeast Louisiana are still facing tonight, 3 days after Hurricane Ida leveled much of the area, and what President Biden will see for himself when he visits on Friday. More than a million are without power, and there are at least 7 storm-related deaths across 3 states. Robbie Chavez, our NewsHour Communities reporter who is based in New Orleans, begins our coverage.
I've never seen this place like this. Never.
Justin Davis's whole world now lies in a twisted pile of debris. The neighborhood he's lived on for 35 years is in shambles.
You know, I grew up Hurricane Andrew as a little boy, and this right here just was, wow. This is experience, man. I'll never forget this. I don't wish nothing like this or nobody have to go through this in life.
He had planned on hunkering down in his trailer when Hurricane Ida made landfall on Sunday, but he had to take cover before his home collapsed around him. His town in Lafourche Parish had taken a direct hit from the storm. Amid sweltering summer heat, where temperatures felt like 105 degrees in parts of the state, Davis is among the hundreds of thousands who remain without electricity, air conditioning, or tap water for a third straight day. And the search for fuel to power generators is becoming more difficult by the day. In Davis's hometown of Raceland, residents lined up at a food distribution center today run by the National Guard, but they only received limited supplies for a day.
We need help real bad.
What did you come here looking for today, and what did you get, and did you get everything?
I'm satisfied. I came in, I got some water in a box, and I got a meal, you know, so I'm thankful for that.
Robbie Lee is the director of communications for the Lafourche Parish government. He said while some residents have begun returning to their homes, he's urging as many as possible to stay away because he expects power won't return for months.
One of the biggest concerns is getting residents to their homes. The roads are very unsafe to travel right now. There's a large amount of power lines down. Right now, we currently have no water at all, no running water, no clean water for residents.
In New Orleans, a glimmer of hope emerged Wednesday as power was restored to a section of the city. Distribution sites were set up by officials and local charities where people could receive meals, water, and ice, and simply sit and cool off for a few minutes.
Primary objectives today are getting our people what they need. We know they need food, water, cool air, and so we are moving forward with the full complement of additional resources on today.
For residents in Grand Isle, Louisiana, where Ida took direct aim, the devastation has made the barrier island uninhabitable. Grand Isle Police Chief Scooter Resweber says he and many of his family members and colleagues lost their homes.
In my neighborhood, I lost my home. My grandson lost his home. I have a deputy that lost his home, a sergeant that lost his home.
The living room and bathroom is back here.
In the bayou town of Golden Meadow, James Segrina got emotional as he surveyed the remains of what used to be his home.
Dryer and washer somewhere is up in there. Yeah, the fact the washer's right there. So. But I moved it from over here about 8 foot.
Segrina has been in this area his entire life and is still struggling to make sense of what's happened. His boat was destroyed as well.
Busted the windows out, and the rain poured in, and it's made it sink. But it's heartbreaking.
The remnants of Hurricane Ida are now causing what the National Weather Service has called significant and potentially life-threatening flooding for parts of the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic regions. Flash flood warnings have been issued from North Carolina all the way to Maine. While Ida has moved on from Louisiana, residents like Justin Davis have no idea when life will ever return to normal. Buddy says many here in the town of Raceland are committed to staying and rebuilding.
Hey, Pops, where you at?
We tagged along as he checked on neighbors and his dad, who lives just down the street.
We all gonna stick together and do what we have to do to get this back going as a family.
Evacuees are just eager to return. They want to get back here, survey the damage on their own homes, and they also want to come in and help their neighbors. But it's a dire situation. There is no food, no water, no power, and no answers of just when it's going to be safe to return. Judy?
And Robbie, it's just so hard to imagine the amount of devastation, but we see it in your report. Tell us, what is the latest on getting people the help, the support that they need?
Well, it's going to be very, very slow to come. And right now, just the basics of food and water, what people need. Today, we watched the National Guard hand out meals ready to eat and also 3 quarts of water for people to last them for a day. The other big concern is just medical care. A lot of the pharmacies here are closed. 2 of the major hospitals in this area are closed. There's only 1 emergency room to service all these people. And so it's going to be tough for them. In fact, today, we ran across a man who was sitting in his truck. He was gasping for air. He had stage 4 lung cancer and he needed oxygen, but he didn't have the electricity to run the machines to give him that oxygen. So we went ahead and we called emergency services and got him the help that he needed.
Oh, my goodness. Thankfully, you were there for that one man. And Robbie, so much discussion before the hurricane about whether the levees would hold. What is the information that you have on that? Have they been holding?
Yeah, so in the area that we were today in South Louisiana, in Lafourche Parish, there are still some levees that there are areas of concern. In fact, in Lafourche Parish, they spent the day packing those levees with sand, hoping to avoid another breach. If that water breaches, it will just make matters even worse.
And one other thing, Robbie, you were talking about people without water, without running water. If they don't have it and they don't expect to get it soon, how are they coping?
Well, you know, again, officials have said don't come back because we don't have the infrastructure to help you out. And I talked with a few people down here who were emptying their pools to flush their toilet using the water in buckets to wash their hands. I mean, that's the kind of situation that they're living in for now. And it could be as long as a month or even 2.
Robbie Chavez, thank you so much. Such important reporting.
Thank you, Judy.
From Imprisoned Nation.
In Arkansas, a doctor has been giving jail inmates with COVID-19 a drug not recommended by the FDA. Ivermectin is a medicine often used to treat parasites in animals and humans, and it's been subject to a fair bit of misinformation among COVID vaccine opponents. Jacqueline Froelich of member station KUAF joins us from Fayetteville. And Jacqueline, tell us about this doctor who's been prescribing this and what the drug is.
Yeah, his name is Dr. Rob Karras. He operates Karras Healthcare. It's a walk-in cash clinic in Fayetteville. He's also under contract with Washington County to care for jail detainees, operating as Karras Correctional Health and along with treating jail patients infected with COVID-19. He uses a complex of nutritional supplements, asthma medicine, and steroids if in respiratory distress. And he's also giving them a generic drug known as ivermectin. Karras is convinced that ivermectin is safe and effective to treat COVID-19 infection.
Well, he may be convinced, and I understand he's used it on his own family members, but as far as the FDA is concerned, it is not approved for COVID-19, correct?
Right. Ivermectin's commonly used to treat parasites in both animals and humans, and I have been asked by listeners to report on ivermectin because they believe so strongly in it. Kara says FDA has approved the use of it for decades and that the World Health Organization considers it to be a critical and safe medicine. But again, that's only for internal parasites. FDA has issued a really strong warning that ivermectin is not approved to prevent or treat COVID-19 and that it may cause harm.
I understand the FDA is doing its own look, its own trials in case they find that this is useful for COVID-19. But as far as this county jail population, how long has Dr. Karras been treating these inmates with ivermectin?
This is the thing. No one knew this was going on. He's been prescribing ivermectin since November, but it wasn't publicly known until last week when a county justice of the peace, Eva Madison, who received a tip about it from a county employee, brought the matter before the Washington County Quorum Court. I spoke with Madison on Saturday, who had also contacted the county sheriff, Tim Helder, texting him a complaint. This is what she said.
I took that to the sheriff thinking, hey, the sheriff just must not know about this. I'll let him know. He'll fix it. And much to my surprise, he responded back that, well, they're only giving ivermectin to positive patients at the jail. And he seemed to think it was a good thing.
Okay. And finally, Jacqueline, then what happens from here? Is this doctor still planning to continue prescribing this medicine?
At this time, it's not known. He's continuing to prescribe it at his practice, but we don't know the status inside the jail. The Arkansas Medical Board has opened an investigation after receiving a formal complaint by a resident. And a growing number of detainees, it's being reported, are coming forward upset that they were told by Dr. Karras that ivermectin pills were vitamins. He insists no inmates are forced to take the drug and are fully informed about the medicine. The ACLU of Arkansas also issued a statement over the weekend saying that no one, including incarcerated individuals, should be subject to medical experimentation. So we're just waiting to see what the Arkansas Medical Board has to say about all this.
Okay, that's Jacqueline Froelich of KUAF reporting in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Thanks, Jacqueline.
You're welcome.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Hate crimes in the U.S. are on the rise. The FBI reports that bias-motivated attacks are at their highest level in 12 years. NPR's Carrie Johnson is here to talk with us about the new data. And Carrie, what is the FBI saying about these incidents over the past year?
The Bureau says these crimes are up 6% year over year, and that increase is really notable, especially when it comes to hate crimes that are motivated by the race or ethnicity of the victims. The FBI says the Black community bore the brunt of these incidents in 2020, but Asian American and Pacific Islanders were also targets of a lot of hate. The Attorney General Merrick Garland says there needs to be an urgent response. He says all people in this country should be able to live without fear of being attacked or harassed because of where they're from, what they look like, whom they love, or how they worship.
So what's the federal government doing to try to prevent these incidents and bring perpetrators to justice when they happen?
The Justice Department has been reaching out to communities. It's trying to make information about how to contact authorities available in languages other than English. And it's encouraging states and local jurisdictions to report these crimes to the FBI. Right now, these reports are voluntary. Experts say these crimes are severely underreported. Here's just one example. The Anti-Defamation League says more than 60 large jurisdictions nationwide reported no incidents, none at all, to the FBI last year. And they say that's really hard to believe. And all too often, there's another issue. Survivors of these crimes don't report to authorities because they lack trust in the police or they worry about the consequences if they're undocumented people.
What are civil rights groups saying about this increase in hate crimes?
I reached Derek Johnson, the president of the NAACP, a few hours ago. He says the Justice Department needs to bring more criminal prosecutions. He says it's about accountability.
We must turn back the clock of the rise in racial hate crimes and hold people accountable and make sure social media platforms are not being leveraged to sow seeds of hate, because when that happens, communities are put in danger and, in fact, our democracy is put in danger.
Carrie, you also mentioned that attacks have increased against Asian Americans. What are those groups saying?
Stop AAPI Hate, which advocates for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, says since March of 2020, they've received over 9,000 reports about verbal harassment, discrimination, and even physical assaults targeting Asian Americans. Those reports are from all 50 states. And things have gotten so bad that some Asian Americans are going outside only after they put on a mask, sunglasses, and a hat, a kind of protection from people who might want to harass them. Manju Kulkarni co-founded Stop AAPI Hate. She says the Justice Department can also step up. She wants to see them file civil lawsuits over discrimination and hateful incidents in the workplace and in schools. She points out that those civil cases have a lower legal bar to succeed than criminal cases. Here's a little more from her.
When we look at civil prosecution, what one of the benefits is that it is forward-looking. You have an opportunity to change behavior. You have an opportunity for trainings. And it's really forward-facing.
All right. That is NPR's Carrie Johnson on the new hate crimes report from the FBI. Thank you very much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
When are we as Black people going to have the level of self-respect and courage to really come out of the slave role, slave obey your master, turn the other cheek. Make certain you turn the other cheek and you'll get your reward in heaven. And that's a slave role. We haven't maybe thought about it in those terms.
Well, I can't let it build up. I can't let what happened to me just make me think that everybody's like that. It just makes me be more cautious.
A teenager staying positive after an Oklahoma man is caught on camera yelling racial slurs at her.
She says he also threatened to kill her. She's telling Only News 9's Clayton Cummins she forgives him. Clayton?
Yes, she does, Kelly and Amanda. All of this happening as the suspect, 22-year-old Peyton Hurd, who's out of jail on bond from a different case in 2017. He's accused of raping a minor in that case.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
All of this happening as the suspect, 22-year-old Peyton Hurd, who's out of jail on bond from a different case in 2017. He's accused of raping a minor in that case.
Police are called to Baker's Bridge in Guthrie, a known rural hangout spot for teens.
Come on! You off film?
It's here where friends of 22-year-old Peyton Hurd are seen holding him back from attacking a teenager.
It was cool for about 30 minutes, and all of a sudden, he starts flipping out, saying, we need to leave. I need to go especially.
18-year-old Zaria Hurd says things escalated from there. She begins recording when Hurd begins screaming racial slurs.
You're going to shoot me in between my eyes. Brayden, this your friend. Here, he starts yelling the N-word. He spits in my face, and then he starts throwing rocks.
This guy's being, like, really racist. He threw a rock at me. So
I need help.
Zaria was hit in the temple, not seriously hurt. She says Heard threatened to shoot her.
He went to go grab the gun, and then I kind of ran off because I didn't want to see the gun. I'm terrified of guns as is.
A friend of Heard, police say, drove off after the incident.
The officers had pulled over the vehicle that the suspect was in. They identify the suspect who's not driving, and also there's a loaded firearm in the vehicle.
Brayden, this your friend.
Zaria says she forgives the suspect but hopes a judge makes an example of him.
I didn't feel like I was worthless, but it just made me feel like I was disgusting.
Now, the suspect is charged with a hate crime, gun possession, and assault. He's out of jail right now on bond. I'm Clayton Cummins, Oklahoma Zone News 9.
In your reports, you were talking about Algiers Point and the white residents specifically in Algiers Point. And you talked about the siege mentality, direct quote, that the white people had in Algiers Point, and specifically the stockpiling of weapons and assault rifles, shotguns, handguns, an Uzi. I guess could you share with our listeners more about exactly what this siege mentality entailed and just the amount of weapons that these people had and just, you know, as much detail as you could share about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is one thing that tripped me out is that, you know, people in this neighborhood, white folks in this neighborhood, they cut down trees and they dragged downed trees and scrap lumber and other things out into the roads to block off the streets so people couldn't come through there. And then they began patrolling the streets in vehicles and on foot, armed with all kinds of weapons. And one of the main people involved in this, one of the organizers of this sort of militia activity told me, he said, look, what we did is we went around to the houses of people who had left and went in their houses and found their guns and amassed their guns. And we, you know, whenever we could, we let them know that we were getting their guns. But we went and got them. And then, you know, after a day, we had about 40 different weapons. And so they had this, you know, this cache of 40 arms, shotguns, assault rifles, like you said, an Uzi. And as well as I understand it, there were people coming in from out of town and, in fact, from other states coming equipped with their own arms and their own trucks to join the effort. And that is something I've heard repeatedly from people who would know for the last 2 years, that this was not even purely contained to folks that lived in this neighborhood, but that there was a broader sort of paramilitary effort there with people coming in from outside to join this little army.
It's 19 News.
The rain has stopped. The wind is still going there. I think we even have a random person going around.
19 News has learned the man charged with assaulting this television reporter has a violent history.
Yeah, he's actually currently facing allegations of trying to harm his former employees at a Cleveland area business.
Yeah, Kristen Mazur joins us live in downtown Cleveland. And Kristen, certainly as journalists, we know we're trained to expect anything really on live TV.
That's certainly true. As we saw on my 4 o'clock report, you know, live TV, anything can happen, right? Including your fake eyelash just flying off while you're reporting out here on a windy day. The struggle is real, Nikki. It's just the guys, they don't get it. They don't get it. But yeah, as you mentioned, we're used to being out here, used to seeing us out here in these elements. That was exactly what happened for those reporters down south reporting on Ida. But in the video you're about to see, the scariest part has nothing to do with weather.
A now viral video.
This morning, just a couple of minutes ago.
A TV reporter giving a live report on Hurricane Ida.
That's the sense that you're getting, that the rain has stopped.
But the rain and winds weren't the harshest elements you see him face.
Going around, you know, I'm going to turn this way because, you know, we deal with some people every once in a while.
In the video, you see the MSNBC reporter down in Mississippi giving the latest on Ida. When all of a sudden, up runs a man, yelling, screaming in the middle of the live report.
I'm going to toss it back to you because we have a person who needs a little help right now.
The man apparently upset because he said the news report wasn't accurate. Now the reporter keeping his cool, but the irate man not giving up. Even crazier, that guy isn't from Mississippi. He's from right here in Northeast Ohio. That guy right there, 54-year-old Benjamin Dagley from Worcester. Now facing several assault charges, right now on the run, with warrants issued for his arrest. And not the only trouble he's gotten himself into lately. In fact, as 19 News found out, Dagley is currently on probation after a 2017 arrest on the east side of Cleveland, the business known today as the Cleveland Plating Company. Now, according to court documents, Dagley's accused of breaking into the building, drilling holes into the tanks, trying to release very dangerous, very hazardous chemicals. A security guard ended up in the hospital. Al Dagley pled guilty to several related charges, and because of that, isn't supposed to be traveling right now.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
That guy isn't from Mississippi. He's from right here in Northeast Ohio. That guy right there, 54-year-old Benjamin Dagley from Worcester, now facing several assault charges, right now on the run with warrants issued for his arrest. And not the only trouble he's gotten himself into lately. In fact, as 19 News found out, Dagley is currently on probation after a 2017 arrest on the east side of Cleveland, the business known today as the Cleveland Plating Company. Now, according to court documents, Dagley's accused of breaking into the building, drilling holes into the tanks, trying to release very dangerous, very hazardous chemicals. A security guard ended up in the hospital. Al Dagley pled guilty to several related charges, and because of that, isn't supposed to be traveling right now.
So then the biggest question remains is, why was Dagley down in Mississippi, 1,000 miles away from home, and again, in the middle of a major storm? Yeah, so that remaining a mystery. We're going to continue to dig into that to figure that out. Meanwhile, a hearing on his probation violation set for 2 weeks from today. Reporting live in downtown Cleveland, Kristen Mazur, 19 News.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with it one at a time, and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention, we need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the quite collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
Welcome back. The Emmett Till historical marker in Money, Mississippi is missing. According to the Emmett Till Interpretive Center, the marker appears to have been hit by a car and then removed. This picture shows where the historical marker usually stands. This past Saturday was the 66th anniversary of Emmett Till's lynching.
Do you know what today is?
this the city of Chicago.
Chicago.
The man knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Tim Fanks, a Chicago police lieutenant charged with battery and misconduct. It all stems from an incident involving a suspected carjacking.
These charges coming after the arrest of two other officers this week.
Nate Rogers live for us tonight with the story. Nate.
Current Don, Lieutenant Wilfredo Roman has 21 years with the Chicago Police Department. His attorney tonight says he is indeed an innocent man with several awards under his belt. The attorney tonight calling the charges against him completely false. Lieutenant Wilfredo Roman Jr. appeared before a Cook County judge Thursday, facing aggravated battery and official misconduct charges, both felonies. Court documents say the incident happened as the 45-year-old police lieutenant was pursuing two carjacking suspects here in the 2000 block of LeClaire Avenue back in February. Once the suspect was under arrest, prosecutors say he'd complain that the handcuffs were too tight. Court documents say Roman told the teenager to shut up. He then, quote, approached from behind and shoved his flashlight in between the suspect's butt. Even more, prosecutors say when the flashlight was removed, Roman walked away, then turned and yelled, quote, that's what you get for carjacking.
It happened in a split second. There's a punch to the butt. If you look at the evidence in light most favorable to the state, it is not an intrusion, a penetration of any kind. This is just what is shocking is the charging of an innocent man.
This all comes after police officers Victor Gubara and Jeffrey Schaefer were arrested Monday for allegedly beating a teenager following a car chase back in January. Also, as this video went viral earlier in the week of another officer seen allegedly attacking Nikita Brown at North Avenue Beach. Now, quite interesting, Corey and Dawn. According to the Chicago Tribune, Roman has more than 40 civilian complaints during his policing career. Those complaints include allegations of excessive force and false arrest. Roman is now released on an I bond. He has been relieved of his police powers. He's awaiting trial while he is assigned to desk duty. Live outside Chicago Police Headquarters, Nate Rogers, Fox 32 Chicago.
Black male privilege. Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 4, 2021. So I have been told. Black male privilege. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, questions, counter-racist suggestions. The number, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Lengthy list of things to address before we get to the callers. I will just say this broadcast, context of white supremacy, context. Chicago Public Schools, they made a settlement, a part of their reparations package. Decades of terrorism, Chicago Police Department, John Burge, who I believe is a Vietnam veteran, just like Mark G.E.D. Furman. But a part of their reparations package was they were supposed to talk about, honestly, the white terrorism that happened in the Chicago Police Department. They're targeting black males, torturing them, all of it. And that included putting electric prods on the testicles of black males. If they've done their job, students, young scholars in Chicago should immediately be able to make connections between that report that we just heard, alleged carjackers, and
The procedure is, if you are accused, suspected of a carjacking, insert flashlight in rectum. Immediate connections. Like, wow, this sounds like John Birch. They doing the same things? I thought they stopped all that. Context. Pamela Evans Harris, City of Chicago. That's Dr. Welsing, too. Anywho, lengthy list before we get to the listeners. Invest, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. You can hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Cash App is also linked there. The address for Cash App, cash.app/$TheCows. Enormous gratitude to all of the investors who have kept the cows on the air for 12 plus years. Hope the cows has been worthy of your time, energy, investments. Hopefully providing mostly accurate, constructive information on things that we can be doing, non-white people, to solve this problem immediately. Whew, let's see. Did not think we would hear Tony twice in the same week on the cows, but we did. Get to that when we get to words. I will say really quick, this doesn't really have anything to do per se with a news clip, or I guess maybe we'll have to see. But I spoke with a victim off the air this week, victim of white supremacy, and we were just talking about all of the madness of, you know, 2021, lengthy list. And man, I mean, frequently with victims, every time we do a compensatory call in, I always have anti-blackness as a hashtag and something to think about. That's one thing that we can do. Black self-respect. Dr. Welsing talked about that all the time. I'm going to reflect my commitment to attempted counter-racism every time I'm in contact with a black person. Be working not to be in conflict, working if I can help that person in a constructive way, if they need help or anything of that manner, just looking to be constructive with other black people. No conflict. I was talking to this victim, and man, it was lots of blaming black people, and black people are dumb, and oh, some of the favorite rhetoric. Black people, we allow racism. We tolerate all of this. We don't hold each other accountable. It's all the classic rhetoric, right, about how we blame, basically, other black people for the existence of white supremacy racism. Very, very common. Shadow fighting, as Mr. Fuller calls it. So after we've had, you know, a robust turn of this, get to the end and it's, hey, look, Gus, not all white people are bad. Some of them have a different space of consciousness and, you know, some of them can help you do some great things. Victims guaranteed qualified. Incidentally, I find it amazing, extraordinarily important, significant, highlight, bold, phrase, print. I do not make an effort to convince anyone that all white people are racist. I saw years ago, I think at this point I could say more than a decade ago, it is impossible. There are some things you have to come to a conclusion on your own. I just asked the question, what does it mean to be white? Talking racial classifications, what does that mean? That's all I do. It is amazing the number of people that I have who spontaneously, unprovoked, feel the need to inform me that not all white people are racist. Incidentally, none of these folks has ever provided me with a accurate, perfected criterion for how you pick out the not racist white folks. That notwithstanding, I just sat there for a moment like, wow, I had to listen to a lot of bashing and blaming black people. And then I got on the way out, Not all white people are racist.
Like, wow.
What a doctor with A pluses for white people. They have done a job on victims of white supremacy all over the world. Black self-respect. Let's see. Next. The Martinsville 7, Gus T., born in the great state of Virginia, Coon Man, Governor Ralph Northam. I never heard of the Martinsville 7. I say that all the time. Learn local history wherever you happen to be. Michigan, Chicago, so you know all about John Burge. Or if you grew up in Florida, Claude Neal. New Orleans, I mean, you got to be a PhD scholar on Katrina and a whole lot of different aspects of racism in that part of the world. But I mean, just learning local history. You can make little field trips and go to different parts of, you know, the county or your city, even your state. Lots of different ways that you can make local history. You're also learning about racism, white supremacy, and spending time constructively, hopefully, with some non-white people. But man, and when I heard that, I had just spoken with an investor in Virginia. We were discussing Martinsville, and they were telling me about people they met from Martinsville. Like, do you know Martinsville? Because, like, of course I know Martinsville. I was born in Virginia. How would I not know Martinsville? Lame though it is. Let's see. Next. When they talked in that segment, Victims Guaranteed Qualified, they talked to some of the family members of these executed black males, black male privilege. And they said they were so happy about this pardon. Incidentally, I don't celebrate posthumous pardons. They do this a lot, like Jack Johnson. They've been trying to do this for Marcus Garvey. They'll get a black person who's been dead sometimes like 150 years and decide, oh, yeah, we did mistreat that nigger 150. You are pardoned. I think all that is a waste of time, but that's Victims Guaranteed Qualified for Gus T. as well. Anywho, so they got some of the victims, family members to come out, and they said, reminded me of James Brown. And I was thinking that they were going to say black and proud, which I didn't want to laugh because, I mean, it's supposed to be kind of an important, serious occasion. But, like, ooh, I think people know I have sound clipped black and proud many times. Mr. Fuller has talked about that as well. Anyway, they didn't go black and proud. They would get on the good foot, which change without improvement. Next, man, George Washington Carver. One, I really would have appreciated it if it had been black people with a different type of perspective, more in line with white supremacy, racism, using accurate language and a perspective based in these are individuals classified as black, and we're going to discuss this experience in that way, using those terms and not kind of pussyfooting the language and being kind of watering down, well, I won't use a metaphor, minimizing the terrorism of white people and all this and what happened. Dr. Yomo Mutegi, a black male, he discussed Carter G. Woodson on his second visit to the cows, or actually, I think, more in depth the second time around. And he kind of led into that clip. He gave so much detail. I didn't even give. He said a lot more, but I would have so appreciated that. But I played that clip because it's not too often where I actually get to hear Dr. Or George Washington Carver actually speaking. So that was why I wanted to play that segment. From there, I think I said Carter G. Woodson, George Washington Carver. The reason I thought it was so important, like all of the material that he created from peanuts, I had no idea. They're like peanut milk and all these products that they have at like Whole Foods and Sprouts that you go in and have to pay, you know, your whole paycheck to get like an ounce of cashew butter or something like that. And he was making this 100 years ago from peanut veal. Like, are you serious? They would charge like $20 a pound for that in the store right now. Like, the genius, George Washington Carver, genius, black genius. And Dr. Welsing, she used to talk about George Washington Carver on a pretty regular basis. I thought it was so important in the segment. They played the audio so you could hear Mr. Carver, the host of the segment, when they came back, and said his voice was almost lilting. Now, when we discussed Mr. Carver, Dr. Jomo Mutegi and some of our other guests said, hey, when he was stolen by these racist slave catchers and all the rest of it, George Washington Carver was castrated just like Emmett Till. May explain his voice not being too heavy. Still learning, so that may not be accurate, but we discussed that. We even discussed about a year and a half ago, we discussed seeing if we could get a biography, a really good one, on George Washington Carver so we could know more about him. Anyway, I thought it was also so important in that segment. There was a lot of snickering in the lead up to he went out in the woods and the forest and just thought that, wow, this is God. Lots of people have had that experience, a spiritual connection in nature, very common. And she starts giggling and says, he says the plants talk to him. Why is that funny? Particularly when you go back and look at that list of all the things that he created from peanuts and biofuel and all that. He's doing this 100 years ago. Why is that laughable to think that maybe the plants? Dr. Welsing talked about that. She said, highly melanated black male. Chlorophyll, melanin are similar in terms of the scientific structure of these elements. We're all still learning. Maybe they did. I think they have, isn't that documentary, The Secret Life of Plants? Don't they say that the plants communicate with each other? I think I saw that one. I think that's the main takeaway, that they communicate with each other and can kind of organize if there's a fire and all of that. Maybe this, hey, this George Washington Carver fellow is pretty cool. At least he's not a racist. Haven't seen him chopping anyone's testicles off. We'll chat it up with him. Share a few secrets. Let him know what he can do with that peanut. Why is that laughable? Why is that impossible? They got sci-fi with all kinds of goofiness. We got flying skateboards and all the rest of it. Why is that so goofy? George Washington Carver. Genius. Let's see. And in the segment they had the white woman. She was talking about how the white landowners, they would steal from and rob from the black sharecroppers. She said there were rapacious whites. Rapacious. She didn't say racist. She said rapacious whites. Rapacious means that you're greedy, that you would tend to overcharge people and that sort of thing. And then she said they didn't have to be rapacious. The tendency was for people to overcharge. One, it would be white people because you didn't have a whole lot of black property owners at this time period. This is like early 1900s. And it wouldn't be, they wouldn't have to be rapacious. It would be, they wouldn't have to be racist, which again, man, how do we keep coming back to not all white people are racist? They wouldn't even have to be racist. She didn't even say racist. She said rapacious. Words are important. And if they're robbing everyone, well, then they are rapacious and racist. Words. So important. Let's see. Next. White people do not care about children. Oh, my goodness. I can't say it enough. I guess before I get to that, the segment, Wendell Pierce with New Orleans. One of our listeners, I believe, dialed in. We had the program on Monday, was not scheduled, where we discussed Hurricane Ida and the anti-looting patrols in New Orleans that they unleashed this week. And they had pictures of black people. They had pictures, excuse me, of black people looting the beauty salon and liquor store in New Orleans shortly after Hurricane Ida vacated. Got the return of the looter. We had it all. That segment, I normally don't even play. I said before, I'm not playing anymore. Melissa Harris Perry, that was Melissa Harris Perry. Dropped my ego and commitment because I thought it was so important what William Pierce had to say about his father's escape from New Orleans. His father at 96, World War II veteran. Again, they have former President Trump and these folks come out and shake their finger at Colin Kaepernick. You're disrespecting our veterans and get off your knee and no count Negroes and you're fired. You are escaping a Category 4 hurricane at 96 years old. I'm a World War II veteran. They don't even have that many of them on the planet. I bought a room. I'm not coming here to beg. I didn't come here to make a compensatory investment request. Could you hook us up with a room? Can we use the bathroom? Wendell Pierce paid for the rooms and it's get out of here. We gave you rooms already. As a matter of fact, get off our parking lot before we call the police and have you looters arrested. World War II veterans and the respect for elder, all of it. Right, right. And it was children there, right? Because we care about children. We care about the children. Can't forget that. Children who apparently maybe one of them had some sort of medical emergency. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Get out of here. Old looters, baby looters, in-between looters. That's why I played that segment. And I even had to pause because this is the second time I have heard Wendell Pierce, the great Wendell Pierce, extraordinary actor, give a harrowing tale about his father and an extraordinary, like biblically apocalyptic storm in New Orleans. He's in When the Levees Broke, talking about having his father, who was 80 at the time, still a World War II veteran. They go to the insurance company and, oh yes, the levee failure in Katrina knocked your house down and we're not paying for it. Have a great day. Appreciate your service to this great United States of America. And get out of here. Don't stay in our parking lot either. That's in When the Levees Broke, when he says his dad, he didn't even tell him. He was so heartbroken that he just had to leave. And he told him when he got home, because his father's hard of hearing, World War II veteran, father's hard of hearing. And so he waits till they get home to tell him, yeah, they're not paying you anything. To what if you told me I would have killed that man? We appreciate your service, sir. And the same disrespect, the same way Carter G. Woodson, total disrespect of his brilliance. Dr. Yomo Mutegi talked about how the relationship that George Washington Carter had with Henry Ford, motor tycoon, suspected race soldier. And even it might be the reason that they call the facility where they produce the cars, they call it a plant, P-L-A-N-T. Maybe lots of things racists do a really good job of hiding, but they were homies. That is documented. That's why I said we should read a really good biography, or maybe two or three or five, on George Washington Carver so we can be much more informed. But that was Dr. Mutegi's theory. But the same way that they can lie, don't pretty it up, the same way that they can lie and conceal information about George Washington Carver, they can do the same thing about the whole history of jazz in New Orleans and the total lack of respect for those monuments and what have you. They can go beauty up the French Quarter. That was the first area they got power 16 years ago at Katrina, French Quarter. First area they got power this time around, French Quarter, Katrina. Some things change, some things do not. Let's see. Now we can go ahead and get to Peyton Hurd, 22. The segment where this white male, 22-year-old white male, thought the young white people were going to do right. He couldn't even vote when President Obama was in office. This is the segment where this white guy is out terrorizing Zakaria, 18-year-old black female teenager. They're just out at the park trying to chill, enjoy the last little bits of summer. And he comes, nigger, get out of here. And hits her in the head with a rock, threatens to go get a gun and shoot her in the head. She said she forgave him. Now, I've heard lots of, you know, oh, my God, what is wrong with us, Yakun, and forgiving white people? That's why we're in this. All that. She's victim of white supremacy, and she's 18. I mean, that's a child. She's confused, and I'm confused. Like, yeah, that's victims guaranteed qualified. That's not even important. What I thought was important was, oh, wait a minute. Peyton Hurd, regardless of whether we forgive him or not, Peyton Hurd, 22-year-old, he is on bond for child rape? Whoa. Like, you heard. I got to hear about R. Kelly every day. You bashed Bill Cosby, called him a sexual terrorist. Peyton Hurd on bond for child rape. Not rape. Child rape. They said a minor. Somebody said, what did he say? He says, white people don't care about children. And then he comes out and is terrorizing an 18-year-old black female for no reason. Threatens to kill her. I said consistently, expect more of this sort of behavior. But that report, so then we follow that one. We were here on Monday. We did the program Hurricane Ida. Had listeners, I said, hey, if you're watching television, what are you seeing? Because I haven't really been watching TV. I've been reading about things that were happening, but I didn't like sit in front of CNN or MSNBC to see live, you know, TV footage of what was happening with the hurricanes. And so folks said, man, they just had a black reporter on television and some white guy just assaulted him. We talked about this Monday. So I went, read some of the information on the air, said, oh, wow, we'll have to go get more information. That was all I knew about it. Before I even heard about that, I had said, I played the segment today, A.C. Thompson. That was one moment. I'll stand by my work. No need to brag. You just stand by your work. 12 plus years. A.C. Thompson was a guest on the Cows 2009. That is one of the very first programs that we did when the Cows got back on the air. That was May specifically 2009. In fact, I think A.C. Thompson may have been a guest on the Cows before Neely Fuller Jr. was even a guest here. Super, I mean, like first 20 programs when we got back on the air, A.C. Thompson. You heard him. I asked him about this siege mentality, and he talked about how they blocked off the streets and they went and looted. Talk about looters. They went and looted guns from the other white people's houses in the neighborhood. They had an Uzi. All kinds of, they would be ghost guns now and all kinds of stuff, probably a rocket launcher, drones. So they get all this firepower. And he said there were white people who didn't even live in the state who got excited for the opportunity to go and kill black males. That was specific because they gave a body count. It was at least 11 corpses, all black males, where there was a gunshot wound, death under suspicious circumstances. All black males, white people from all over got excited at the opportunity to get their guns, not to go help black people in the midst of a hurricane, but to go kill black males. Hurricane Ida happens this week. This is Shaquille Brewster. Now, the news segment that we heard from News 19 was the racism, white supremacy just within that report alone. They don't even name the reporter. You got video footage, you got a staff, and this is one of your colleagues, one of your brethren, sisters in the industry, right? Why don't we name him Shaquille Brewster? He's out in the middle of a storm, a hurricane, risking life and limb to bring us accurate information. Him down there, it down there, that's all he's worthy of. We won't give him a name. But we do incidentally name the criminal here. He does get named, but we'll get to that later. Before they do all that, the white female journalist who is doing this, her name is Rachel Vadage, V as in Vic, A D as in dog, A J, Vadage. I think that may be how you say it. She's the one who's reporting this. So they go to her and they say, oh man, Rachel, you know the hazards of reporting outside. And she says, oh man. You know, it's rough out here. You know, it's windy sometime. And I was out here earlier today and my fake eyelash just flew off in the wind. And I mean, woof, the struggle is real. The guys, they just don't get it. Now we want to talk about him down in Mississippi and how real the struggle can get. Are you flipping serious? The answer, no. You are not serious. We're about to talk about a black male who you're not even going to have the decency to name, who was assaulted by a white man who's on probation from Ohio. And you're talking about a makeup malfunction earlier in the day. And the struggle is real because of your lost eyelash. Are you serious? The answer, no. Are you serious even about white supremacy racism? No. I mean, maybe you'd have to see the video to get the full display of seeing her like act out losing her eyelash. And then we fast forward or transition to Shaquille Brewster and him getting assaulted down in the middle of a hurricane. And then they give the additional information. Now, come on. Believe it, the struggle is real. They said that this white man, Benjamin Eugene Dagley, 54 years old. We got both ends of the spectrum. 22 with Peyton Hurd, child rapist. And then we got Benjamin Eugene Dagley, 54. They said he's on probation. Why is he on probation? Because he pleaded guilty to breaking into this facility in Cleveland, drilling holes into chemical containers that were noxious and apparently injured a security guard. Why is that not an act of chemical and biological terrorism or some sort of chemical and biological attack? Why is it framed that way? Why is he even out on probation? If Bill Cosby had done that, Gus T, Al Sharpton, and then the pause, like for reals, like what, when I asked that question before, what does it mean to be white? What person from 1,000 miles away, literally 1,000, you're not even in the same time zone. What person looks at this and says, oh yeah, the category 4 hurricane, the apocalyptic storm, I need to be there because some niggers are going to get out of hand and I need to be there to crack the whip. Literally. Who thinks that way? Apparently, there are many individuals classified as white, just according to the record and the evidence. There are many of them. That's how they think. Not we're all in this together. Not let me round up toilet paper, bottled water, generator that I have. No. Let me get my Uzi, my fatigues. It's time to go to war. Lots of reasons, I said, to vacate New Orleans. They said the power may be back sooner than what they initially predicted. Maybe 2 weeks, a week or so, power may be back for most of the residents. Outstanding. I would not want to be in that area. If you could avoid it in any way, shape, form. Wow, white people are so dangerous, and particularly when they know you're in a vulnerable position. Talked about Haiti. Remember that group? They went down to steal children. They didn't go down. Same thing. They didn't go down with blankets, water, meals ready to eat. Nah. Let's steal some children. And then we got probably some Peyton Hurds in the group. Child rapist. Anywho, last thing I'll get in. Anniversary. I talked about that before. I had to pull up and look. I said, maybe I'm messing up. Maybe I just don't understand what exactly an anniversary is. So I said, let me go to the dictionary again. I thought we did this on Monday because they kept saying that this is the anniversary of Katrina. And I said, that is appalling. So the dictionary definition for anniversary: the date on which an event took place in a previous year. The first example they give, so telling: the 50th anniversary of the start of World War II. William Pierce's father. How about that? Now, I don't think that's an anniversary. Why is that the example for an anniversary? Who even celebrates anniversaries for war? Do they celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Korean War? Vietnam War? Dropping of the atomic bomb? Is that an anniversary? Pearl Harbor? Is that an anniversary? And it even more stands out because after they give the example sentence, they say anniversary celebrations. There's nothing to celebrate with war. But the fact that that's the first sentence that you put up, that right there tells me a lot. Same question I said before. What does it mean to be white? What is white culture? Not a wedding anniversary or a business being open 50 years anniversary. Killing, slaughter, death. In fact, if that's what it is, well then maybe Katrina, this is the 16-year anniversary of Katrina. Maybe this is the 66-year anniversary of Emmett Till's castration and murder. Now, incidentally, that would be another one for this, what do they call it, monument? Marker to Emmett Till's murder, lynching, for it to disappear at the 66-year anniversary. You can't be ignorant about white supremacy, racism, and this monument has been attacked repeatedly. They've shot at it and done all same thing that they did to Stephen Lawrence in the UK. We had his mother, Doreen Lawrence, on the program more than once. And she talked about they would do the same thing. They would come and defecate on the monument where her son was killed. Her child, he was 17 at the time, was killed. They would come and break glass and smash it all in the monument. The same type of thing. What is this for? He's been dead. Stephen Lawrence, he's been dead for nearly 30 years at this point. Emmett Till almost did 70 years at this point. What is this for? And what does that idiot say again? He says, because it's Labor Day weekend, sobriety would be best. But the other thing he says is white people do not care about children, flagrantly on display. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943. Pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, suggestions, that would be grand. Just make sure everybody gets at least one chance to speak. If you have extra thoughts, should be ample time for folks to get in additional observations or thoughts. If we could be direct with what we want to say on this broadcast, that would be super appreciated. Words are so important. Race soldiers, they will frequently use metaphors to confound us and have us not really using accurate words to describe things. Victims, myself included, many times we will use metaphors in lieu of logic. We are still learning, so sometimes we don't have all the details, info that we need to articulate our views, and we'll substitute an analogy, comparison of some sort for this broadcast. If we could work to be precise, exact with our commentary, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could kind of get to maybe a quieter area, that would be appreciated, just so we don't have to battle a lot of unnecessary background noise. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Let's see. I think that was... Yes, ma'am. We can hear you. I think that was Confidant, maybe?
It should be Missy.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. Seeing the multiple lines. Yes, Missy, non-Clemson grad. Great to hear you both.
Hello, Gus. Hello, Cal's listeners. I was very interested in the clip about air conditioning. I noticed in the past week there were a lot of articles that came out from different news organizations reporting how us trying to cool our offices, our homes, our other workplaces, schools, churches, and other buildings is causing the planet to heat up. And just to give a little background information, how we used to cool things was with Freon, which was ozone depleting. And then more recently, a lot of the air conditioning and refrigerators and freezers, they converted to HFCs. But these hydrofluorocarbons, those chemicals were also bad for the planet. So it went from ozone depleting to a potential greenhouse gas, which, you know, a lot of the debate around climate change and global warming is centered and always focused on carbon dioxide emissions. But it's very rare for articles and for people to discuss other chemicals that are greenhouse gases, like these HFCs that we use for AC and refrigerators. And a lot of these articles, they were talking about how air conditioning is used to separate people by class, by race, by economic means. And What I've noticed is we didn't have a lot of conversations around this until the majority of the world started getting AC units in hotels or in their homes, their individual homes. And so as more non-white people or brown people, black people get AC, then it's our fault. It's our fault that we cool our cars, cool our workplaces, whether we're there or whether we're not. And it's becoming more of a problem. And I'm not sure what the answer will be. It just seems like every time we come out with a new chemical solution for cooling our homes, cooling ourselves down so we can work efficiently, it always seems to negatively impact the planet. With that being said, it's very important to be cognizant about what temperature you do have at your house or wherever you are. I know being in corporate America, they like freeze people to death. they freeze them. They set the temperature in the office to a frigid temperature. And there's like a meme always circulating around, like, what do you set your temperature at home to? Do you set it to like 65? Do you set it to 68? Is it at 70 or is it at 78 or 80? And for non-Clemson grad and I, you know, we keep it on the upper end. In addition to saving money, you know, in the electricity bill, you know, keeping it at 78 and 80, for a lot of people, that would be uncomfortable for them. But temperature and feeling cool is relative. Like if I go outside and it's 95 degrees out and I come back in my house and it's only, you know, 78 degrees, it's going to feel cooler to my body. But if you're always used to having your room set to like 65 and you go outside, of course, anything above like 68 is going to feel really warm to you. So I guess we can do what we can do as individuals, but you know, as far as like a global solution, I'm not sure what we can do. With that, I'll end my call.
Much obliged, Miss C. Here in Seattle, the air conditioning days are over. Now, even this summer, we had multiple heat waves. We were a part of that report. We had that 110 degree day back in June. Even with all of that, it is the temperature right now is headed towards the 50s. I just don't think. Yeah, move to Seattle. I guess that's one thing folks could do. I was trying to think the thermostat. It's so cool here. Like you could just, you know, whatever. The AC doesn't need to be on, so you could just set. I think when I looked at the thermostat last, it was at like 70. Sometimes we'll drop even below 70 because it's not very warm here very much. It's been dropping in the 50s. So you might drop to about 69, which, hey, if people like the house to be at 69, right on. It will be there. Move to Seattle. The AC, we might even have other programs about that coming up because I do notice the same trend as there are most of the planet is populated with non-white people, and they talk about regions of the world with non-white people where they are improving their quality of life and it's hot, so they might now be able to afford AC. It's, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. Can't have all these niggers in the world with air conditioning. Like, whoa. Very common. That, in fact, that's something that they bragged about in these parts. They had lots of articles about that. The white people here bragged about not using AC because they're all about, you know, environmentally friendly and being conscious and recycle and reuse and ride bikes and public transportation and all the rest of it, bike lanes. And so a lot of people bragged about not having AC, and you didn't really need it. I think like about 60% of the houses here don't have air conditioning even right now. After the heat wave this summer, like that has changed. Like that's like a selling point for houses and apartments now. Like we have AC. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie. Not in Louisiana, but definitely our thoughts, prayers with you and friends, family who are still in the Louisiana area, New Orleans area. Hope they are safe and you are too.
Thank you. Yeah, I am. So I don't know if I said this before. It was something that I heard on an album a while back, and I just recently found out who said it, but it was a clip on a Michelle Indigale cello at the end of a song called, quoting Dead Nigga Boulevard. And she played a clip where there was a man saying, when you put property rights ahead of human rights, you tamper with nature. Because property rights are controlled by man and human rights are controlled by nature. And that it came up again this week because of the fact that everything that's happening on the planet is because white people have asserted and assessed that they have property rights to a planet, so much so that they're willing, able, and I guess so impervious to the destruction of the planet in their minds that they'll just leave or whatever, or maybe even die, you know, as it becomes inhospitable. I don't know for sure because I'm not invited to those, you know, conversations that they have, but based on evidence, you know. And I was telling some friends, like, I was like, I think these people been knowing about global warming and what could happen since they came out with the damn Lizzie, to be honest with you. Like, somewhere along the way, they had to see something like, oh, wait. Like, wait a minute, the air ain't so breathable. And something. And learning more and more about Kemet and other ancient places, like in Asia, like I have a friend that I've made past couple months that he spent 2 years in India, and how advanced these people are while being simple. It's like all they've done is go around the world and catalog things and collect things and specimens and look at people and say, okay, well, this is how we're about to fine tune it for our comfort. And the things that we came up with, because they don't come up with nothing on their own. The things we came up with, they ratcheted up in a different manner, and they call it technology, right? And what ends up happening, it doesn't do anything constructive. Like you said, it's change, it's modification without improvement. And I just said that to somebody, like, I promise, like, about a week and a half ago. They're not into improvement. Like, we had, before the storm happened, we had watched the movie WALL-E. And I did a critique, a critical analysis with a notebook, and they were just watching. They didn't have the pencil paper, but I took notes like I did when I was in a special program in high school. And I'm like, these people are destructors. They don't do nothing but destroy. And when I say destroy, they'll demolish nature and natural processes and replace it with something synthetic. And then when that no longer works, and the ecosystem or the planet tries to balance itself out, you know, there's a result from that obviously is destructive because it was a destructive, you know, purpose for it. So the results are destructive. So, but they just get to move on and we suffer the consequences. And that's what Hurricane Ida represents to me. You know what I'm saying? Somebody, probably white, was on YouTube when I was looking up trying to see what was happening where, and they posted a comment on a video. Oh, they keep talking about the news. They keep talking about Katrina on the news where like they haven't buried that yet. I just asked them, where are you from? No, they ain't buried it yet because it's not dead. And I'm like, the insensitivity, I shouldn't even say that. It's just the egotism that's involved with being white, with the power of implementing technology that doesn't do anything as far as a quality of life. I'm to the point that we need to get back to being natural people. The reason we need air conditioning is because we've been the instinct in us to be able to withstand high temperatures has been it's been diluted out of us. I hope that wasn't a metaphor, but we can adapt. And it's going to have to get to a point at this point, because we see white people ain't about to give it up, and they're just going to keep destroying and making things inhospitable. So the sooner probably we learn how to deal with planet Earth the way we used to as natural people, so we can be more universal, the better. Because at this point, what you going to do? Look at what's happening. What do you do when you're in a situation where you've relied on refrigeration, air conditioning, artificial lighting, hell, maybe even now artificial home security? You get Alexa and whoever else to lock your door for you. You're a disabled person when it comes to having to go back and rely on nature in the event that that can't happen anymore. So it seems like to me, the sooner the better. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm disabled as a human being anymore. So I'm making changes to my life, and I'm asking other non-white black people to do it too, because they're also playing games with this COVID stuff. Who knows? If you don't take the shot, they might yank you off the system. I don't know. I don't want to. I just had one more thing to say. I saw a documentary on George Washington Carver, and they said he was close friends with the white gentleman that was over the USDA. I'm suspicious now, listening to the report, that gentleman probably data mined George Washington Carver for all his knowledge. And if anything, he should have been in charge of the USDA, but he wasn't, because he was a victim of racism. And who knows, that information has probably been implemented now into the technology that we see when it comes to genetically modified organisms. You know, like they say, keep your enemies closer. So we that's all I want to say. We gotta get back to nature, so we don't be harmed by these type of events anymore, because we don't have technology at our disposal anymore. And I don't know, just figure something else out. But I'm tired of seeing my people go through this. And I'm my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Irie. Definitely, that is an important one to think about. I think we talked about that on Monday, preparing if you have an attempted family, even if it's just you, preparing if there is some sort of major emergency. That should be included. Like, how dependent are we on electricity? I mean, of course, everybody has a refrigerator and that sort of thing. But I mean, wow, are you? I mean, because there's lots of folks like, man, they are dependent on their smart refrigerator or their Alexa or other gadgets to do everything in the household. So how dependent are we? Would we be totally shut down if the electricity went out? And thinking about that in advance, I think we had some folks last year who were talking about those generators, making sure you get one that does not emit toxic fumes, and not waiting until you need it to find out, ooh, this does emit toxic fumes and might kill us all. I think that got reported in Louisiana this week, where somebody, they had carbon monoxide poisoning suspicion because they had the generator. It might have been in the house or someplace where ventilation was not adequate. Lots of things to think about and plan, but back to nature. And who knows? George Washington Carver may have been studying the impact of all this pollution and what have you way back when. We don't know. We'd be good to read up more on him. But I'm pretty sure, like, if you study and brag about, what does Mr. Fuller say, going to the bottom of the ocean and leaving the planet, I'm pretty sure they've been studying how they are poisoning the planet for a while. Might be why they're leaving to get off of it and what have you. But yeah, I'm sure this is not a total surprise to the most powerful racists. Other folks who dialed in that we missed totally, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. I caught the tail end of the report on Jazz, the unique art form of jazz that was created by foundational Black Americans. And I'll catch it, you know, when I listen to the broadcast again in the archives. But I wanted to ask Irie, given that she's from New Orleans, if when she was growing up, I know that jazz is a part of the local culture there because it, you know, began there. But what I'd like to know as well is when she was in school, if that was also part taught as part of the curriculum for the native born, the Black children that are native of New Orleans, you know, and if that's emphasized as part of their history and culture. And also, too, the other part of my question is, I believe Irie had, during another broadcast, mentioned that she's a performer, and I wanted to know if she also uses jazz or elements of jazz in her performing art. Thank you.
I'm here to answer it. This is interesting because it's not emphasized in the sense you would think. It's almost like, hey guys, you want to play an instrument? Go ahead and join the band. We have a band if you want to. There's no special, like, I don't know what the term would be, but you know how you have a class where you learn like your state history or your city history, and they go through it in detail. No.
Right.
But the reason I had an education in jazz is because my mother was a vocalist and my aunt, and they actually had a record company with some people that are well known in New Orleans. And then I, being a little more mature for my age, would listen to jazz on my own, and then I decided to start playing trumpet. And then that led to me joining like the marching band in high school. So I've been in parades and stuff, and you know, and then later on as an act of rebellion, honestly, once I got out of the military, I started singing. But I do incorporate jazz because I listen to jazz, but New Orleans music in general, and then my mother. So today is actually her birthday, so I say to her, that was the influence for me. It has to come from more so family at this point, because the way they treat jazz in New Orleans, in my opinion, when it comes to children, it's something to be seen, not participated in. And if you don't have a family heritage, which I'm sure you've observed by now, like the Marsalises and the this and the that, if it's not a family heritage, you probably are not going to play an instrument. You probably are going to just be a lay person or do something else that's not even creative for the most part. Even like visual art, even I would say, or performing art, it's a family thing, which may have something to do with racism, because maybe that came about because someone was a slave and they made them play, or I don't know, but that's how it happened for me, and I could be incorrect, but that's my observation. And thank you for asking.
Oh, no, you're welcome. And just shortly, thank you so much for your answer. I really appreciate it. And I just want to say, as a Black person, Black American, I just want to say kudos to the Black people of New Orleans who created this beautiful art form that whites have stolen from us. And I just wanted to say thank you, Irie, for you and the, like I said, the Blacks of New Orleans for its creation. Thank you.
Thank you. And you know what I say to the ancestors, because they brought all that from El Kebelon, from the continent. So everything we do is an imitation of that. I'll mute my line.
Thanks,
Gus. Yes, ma'am. Much obliged. Two times, Irie on the line. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
The black African. Well, I heard him first, so. Yes, ma'am, we heard you as well. Just get the black African first, because I'd already acknowledged him. But we'll get you next.
Thank you. I've been listening to the archives a lot, and I think a couple weeks ago, maybe a few weeks ago, there was with the Haiti earthquake, there was some discussion about that, and I spent maybe two, three weeks in the area where the earthquake hit. This Jeremy and Lakai, about maybe four or five years ago. And I don't know if anybody has been to Haiti. It's very mountainous, a lot more mountainous than I think most people know. And this area is in this Lakai is in a massive valley. And so I think some of the folks were asking about the death count, that it was lower than the previous one. I think even though Port-au-Prince is a massive valley too, people built their homes there. It's not like an agricultural area, but this Lakai is an agricultural area. There's a coastline beach, and then going into it, it's mostly that entire valley is almost all for agriculture. They grow rice and I can't remember the name. It's a grass that I guess they export to France for these perfumes or whatever. It's a major substance that they use. So I think the reason why the death count is lower is because there's just less people and less buildings and homes in that area. And then when I was there, the person that I was there with informed me that a lot of the people after the experience of the past earthquake and hurricane, they built their homes using reinforced concrete. So that's likely another reason. And then people raised their homes too. So a lot of the people responded to the circumstances. Not the circumstances, but the weather conditions and the earthquakes and whatnot. And then the report was talking about access to this area. It's very difficult to get there by road, but then by airport. So we drove by airplane or something, like a small airplane. I was talking to the gentleman that I was there with, and we passed by what seemed like a landing strip for airplanes, but it seemed like it had been either abandoned or destroyed. And he informed me that people, white people, specifically, I guess they were either Swiss or from Sweden, I can't remember, that they would fly in there and they would do sexual terrorism with some of the Haitian people there, with bestiality. And so once more Haitians found out, they kicked these people out and they destroyed the landing strip. So that's one of the reasons why I guess things can't come in, help can't come in through that, through the air. And then just a quick, I think the person follows or listens to this program, they put up an image, the Delectable Negro, where different black people with different skin tones, they had different edible names under there. So I responded to the person, because I had an experience of that in kindergarten with my offspring, who was in pre-K at that time, and where he informed me, hey dad, I'm caramel or something like that. So I was like, what? I kind of lost it. I was like, what are you talking about? So I had to explain it to him, talked to him and everything. And so I wrote the school that, the daycare that he went to. I asked them, why was he being described as an edible item? What were the other types of kids? Like, I think I even asked, like, what were the white and Asian kids described as edible items? And what else did I ask? I asked them if this was on the curriculum. So I didn't get an answer because I had emailed them. And so, like, when I went there, everybody, there was, like, white women there. They were just looking at me like they were just angry. And so I speak with this teacher. I think she'd be classified as so-called Latino or Hispanic. And her response was that it wasn't part of the curriculum, that it was just part of something that they were doing there. And I remember, like, she sort of pointed, like, to sort of, I guess, I don't know, to make it, is it palatable? I don't know if that's a metaphor. To make it seem, well, I guess, delectable Negro, but to make it seem okay, she pointed at a dark black female and said, we describe her as chocolate. So I was just like, oh man, and so I started talking with my mother. She's an educator. She said, I guess this is something that they do. So this is code for parents, that they should talk to their kids prior to going to, like, I guess it would be pre-K, maybe like 3-4 years old, to start to talk about such things. Because I guess when they do their colors, this is part of the colors. Talk to them prior to, I guess that's something that parents should add to their code. Thank you.
The Black African. Man, Neely Fuller Jr., I think, is the first person that I heard who recommended that on saying, let's, you know, not refer to other black people as chocolate this. And, you know, we're talking about lots of ways where black people end up being man not, woman not, child not. Lots of different ways that that's manifested and all that. This was even before we had read Delectable Negro, which, wow. But I even thought when he used the word to make it more palatable, like that's the appropriate word for this context. What are you talking about? That's just a little caramel right here. This is a little chocolate over here. Brownie is one that they'll use. I've heard that, like, we had some white people who adopted a black child, and brownie ended up being their nickname, like all of it. And brilliant questions, like, do we have these sort of edible names for the white children or the Asian children, so-called? And I mean, ooh, if they do, let me get my pen out and write. Are we calling, look at little vanilla. Look at little, I don't even know. I mean, I'm waiting on it. What's it going to be for the Asian children? Like, come on. Look at our little lemon pop. Excellent question. Is this part of the curriculum? And if so, why? Like, how is this going to help us produce intelligent young scholars, calling them karma? We had a black female. She was a journalist. The name of her blog was Caramels on Maple Street. This was a cowbell. She was in some sort of tragic arrangement. That's 12 years. Been here a long time. Confidant, I think it was. Much obliged for your patience, ma'am. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Hi, this is Z's mom. I wanted to comment first on what Irie was saying about how they must have known about climate change for a long time now. I actually recently saw an article from around the 1910s, and they were talking about, I think it might have been in New York Times or a paper that's still around today. And they were talking about coal and how coal produces greenhouse gases, and that we probably shouldn't be using coal because it will affect the climate in a negative way, cause heating of the climate. So I think it's really interesting because they've all obviously had this information for what seems like almost a century now. I also thought it was interesting in that story, the way that they seem to just be accepting climate change. And it's basically about tailoring your life to it instead of, I noticed that the news language now is just like, well, it's here, so there's nothing we're going to do about it, and we're not going to talk about doing anything about it. I think that was really interesting. And I mean, for me personally, I think that there's obviously like climate change affects non-white people to a greater extent. And I know for me, like I was displaced from Los Angeles because of gentrification and the housing market. And where I live now, it's regularly 100 degrees basically for like 6 months out of the year sometimes. And we had a period of time where our AC wasn't even working for about 2 weeks, and it was getting around 90 degrees inside our home. And also, a lot of the places where, I mean, this the place that we had to move to, there's a lot of non-white people who have been displaced from Los Angeles, and all of the air pollution sits here because we're in a valley. So I think, and unfortunately really affects non-white people to a greater extent. I also got the story about Wendell Pierce trying to find a room in Houston. Although it was really commendable the way he kept his cool, was kept calm in that situation. He was really focused on just being solution oriented, and I think he said at certain instances that he was really angry, but he just didn't focus on yelling at the person. I thought it was really interesting how people were getting upset with him for naming the hotel and the worker, especially because a lot of times non-white people are just alleged to have done a crime, and their names and their family names will be on the news for everyone to know, even if they didn't actually commit the crime. I thought about New Orleans not having electricity. I think that every building should have solar panels. Like, it should be included in a home the way that roofs are. It should just be something that everyone has, because it would at least help when your electricity is cut off to have that extra source of energy. I also thought the story about ivermectin was interesting because they said that people shouldn't use ivermectin because it is not FDA approved. But I remember that the COVID vaccine was just FDA approved. So it's kind of confusing that they changed the litmus test. I mean, I don't know much about ivermectin, but I just thought it was confusing how they changed the litmus test for what is usable and what isn't. And then the last thing I wanted to bring up was I read a news story today about an 18-year-old. I think she's a non-white female. She was killed during a boxing match. They had to induce her in coma. And it just reminded me of, I think Gus talks a lot about CTE and football and how dangerous those sports are. I thought it was just really incorrect to have young children playing these type of sports that could ultimately lead to their death. That's all I have to say for now. I'll mute my line.
Z's mom. My bad. Z's mom. Much obliged. Yikes. 100 degree heat, no air conditioning. Yikes. We had that for like, I think like 3-4 days here. 3 days. We had that for 3 days here. The worst. It was unbearable. The death that she's referencing, I'm just reading the first report that I pulled up from today. The boxing world has been left shocked after 18-year-old Jeanette Zapata died after she was rushed to the ICU for injuries sustained in her recent fight. Viewers were left stunned in Montreal last week after Marie-Pierre Houle delivered a number of powerful punches to Zapata in the corner of the ring, and after a solid uppercut left the Mexican stunned. Now, they're saying Mexican. This looks like she could be a black female. Mexican is not a racial classification. Latino, Latinx, none of that is a racial classification. This looks like it could be a black female. A final right hook caused Zapata's mouth guard to fly out and left her unable to return to her corner after the bell rang. And then it just goes on. She collapsed and all the rest of it. Definitely a non-white person. An 18-year-old beaten to death in the ring. Now, this happens. This is not like an anomaly. This is not like, oh my gosh, do you mean somebody? This happens on a, I'm not going to say a regular basis, but I mean, they know. This goes with the territory, as they say. I think that's the metaphor. This is a part of the sport, as they call it, of boxing. From time to time, someone will be beaten to death in the ring. And we'll say, oh, this is regrettable, and we'll have an investigation, and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, hey, Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury 3. Go on to check that one out. I mean, instead, I said that when Dr. We did the Bittersweet Science, Dr. Gerald Horn, earlier this spring. I said they will look back when we get to a system of justice. They will look back at both football and boxing. Barbarians. Can you believe that? An 18-year-old beaten to death in the ring for entertainment? That's the type of culture where you end up with. Hurricane Katrina's anniversary, castration of Emmett Till's, and or the 66-year anniversary of Emmett Till's castration. This is the type of culture, yes, entertainment, where we watch someone be beaten to death. System of white supremacy. Traveling again for that. Like, I got to go cross the border into Canada to disgraceful. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed. Let's see. That one, Confidant, yes.
Mr. Renegade, I agree with you. Oh, that boxing story is tragic. I agree with you that white people do not care about children. My report, the high school district in the area that I'm allowed to live in has a new student dress code. You might ask, why is this? Well, the rationale for this change is the district trustee's daughter was sent home from school in the second grade for wearing shorts that were deemed too short. The trustee's daughter is now 14 years of age. So for approximately 7 years, the trustee has been determined to have the school district's dress code changed to make it more, wait for it, quote, inclusive. I think the school's intent may have been to be helpful in maintaining standards, and if a female child, or adult for that matter, is dressed very provocatively in public, it can be a distraction for males, truth be told. Which is one reason I support school uniforms. I believe children learn better in an academic setting where the emphasis is on education and not clothing. And if I had my daughters, more children, especially black children, would be homeschooled. Further, in my opinion, this female, who is now 14 years of age, could be the first one of the females to scream sexual harassment, which, by the way, I am against. You know, bad things have been documented to have happened to children, molestation, etc., as well as adults. So what I'm saying is, why not guard against as best we can as parents by having especially female children dress modestly? They can still have some creativity and individualism, I think. Now, what does the new changes in the dress code mean when they say it was rewritten to be, quote, more inclusive? Well, The new policy states, quote, students should be allowed to wear clothing that makes them, quote, comfortable. But where are the adults? I mean, the policy also states not only should they wear what makes them, quote, comfortable, the policy also says, quote, to not reinforce stereotypes, nor facilitate marginalizing or discrimination, oppression of any group based on, wait for it, race, sex, gender identity, gender expression, sexual orientation, ethnicity, religion, cultural observance, socioeconomic status, or body type or size. I don't even know what they're talking about. All school officials did was ask the student to change his put on pants a tad bit longer. But in one fell swoop, the standards have been greatly diminished in the public school system. Not only is this trustee a mother, she also teaches 7th and 8th grade. And here's the clincher. The teacher's trustee said, quote, as a teacher, I have often thought the dress code unfairly targets girls, and in some cases, people of color, I don't know how we got into this, with regard to hairstyles and whatnot, quote, she said, unquote. The new dress code provisions also protect the rights of, quote, transgender students to wear what they want, close quote. So again, in one fell swoop, 7 years in the making, public education in this district has changed, and not for the better, in my opinion. And by the way, if this had been a black female child with shorts on, she may have been led away in handcuffs and suspended indefinitely. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged. I believe that's Phoenix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Switched the lineup on me, but we got it. Much obliged for sharing. We've had so many different people. We just heard from Z in California. Bay Area mom also in California. We've had so many different parents talking about the sexual acting out and how sexualized the children are. And just talking about the music and everything is just hyper-sexualized and seeing the children respond to that. Dr. Welt, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. And to me, that is super logical to within that context. You got Jerry Sandusky. You got, matter of fact, let's go current. Peyton Hurd, 22, child rapist. You got these type of individuals and lots of them running around. Woody Allen. I said that for years. Like, let's be a bit on the prudish side. Everybody, you know, school environment, work environment. I said that for years. Like, we're not going out trying to look cute for everybody. Like, oof, let's try as best we can. Like, and reason being for that, again, lots of sexual abuse is encouraged. Sexual molestation encouraged, especially, hey, don't care about children, especially if they're black. Go all the way to Haiti not to take them a can of tuna fish, rape and steal some children. Heard that two times. The black African talked about that as well. Makes sense to me. Incidentally, I mentioned Woody Allen. We had the discussion about jazz in New Orleans. Woody Allen, in his autobiography, he does all that talking about Louis Armstrong and Thelonious Monk, and he loves the primitive sounds of the black male New Orleans jazz men. You think Woody Allen dipped into some of his, you know, fortunes, immense? Let me send a few dollars down to New Orleans. Let me send a few dollars to help, you know, preserve some of the artifacts and things. These black jazz musicians have meant so much to me and my life and enriched my experience. Least I can do. Here's a few nickels. Maybe he did. Maybe they just didn't make a big to-do about it. I'm curious. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Greetings, everyone.
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I would just like to give a suggestions to everyone on the line, and also to suggest that you share with others. I heard a report not too long ago that some governmental officials, whether it was state or federal, apologizing for not being prepared to the different issues that are induced by the new environment that we find ourselves in, which is code for me of a very sophisticated way to not have to assist targeted people, similar to places like in Haiti or anywhere where non-white people do not have the means to solidify their place of residence, adequate and healthy food sources, where they have to go far places with inadequate transportation, in areas where it is adequate, they may have some uncomforts and a level of suffering, but it would be disaster in those places like Haiti or a lot of environments where non-white people, especially non-white people who are classified as black, stay. So my suggestion is that just make it a part of your daily, not necessarily be daily, but make it a monthly, monthly practice to keep up a food source that can last you for 2 weeks or more, water source that you save, put away, of drinkable water, to be prepared for these things. We're going to have to understand that under a global system of racist white supremacy, non-white people are always in a warlike condition. So therefore, it would be advisable to be war ready. And also, it makes relevant to what Mr. Fuller has been stating for, I've been hearing him state this for at least 20 years. The whole idea of stop collecting things in your place of residence that you have to be accountable for if some sort of disaster take place, you know, and these things that I'm talking about can take place in a short period of time where you wouldn't have time to put in the boxes and load up into a truck, you know, certain things. Just kind of like restrict your environment where you reside. I know the whole idea about some level of stylishness. Maybe you could have two things at the same time, but I would advise that you first think about the means to be able to move at an adequate at an adequate rate in times of a disaster, whether it's quote unquote natural. And I'm saying quote unquote natural on purpose, or something that is created by another group of people. Be able to gather whatever needs to be gathered and remove yourself and others at a recordably fast period of time. And, you know, you may once every 2 months practice it. Have a practice. Elderly, if it's elderly, someone who needs special assistance, to be able to know public transportation routes that are to be used for these type of occasions, so you won't have to depend on it coming from a television that may be out. Of course, to collect, keep batteries around. Don't wait until it's quote unquote hurricane season or tornado season or whatever, or because now the climate situation is to a point to whereas the season could be 325 days out of the year at some point in time, or any one of those days out of the year, as opposed to a quote unquote season. So just think about those things. Think about those things. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Great tips. Would expect nothing less, retired firefighter. Especially just so that you can stay informed in terms of, you know, what's the news or radio stations, that sort of thing. They even have little radios that have a crank on them, a hand crank on them. No batteries required, no, you know, plug-in, nothing. You can just crank and boom, have a radio. You can get all the information that you need and would last as long as you need it. Super cheap, you know, low-tech. Might be something good just to store in your, you know, emergency bag just in case. Like something that could come in handy in a situation like New Orleans where you don't have electricity and it's looking like power might be kind of difficult. At least you can have a radio to kind of get updates about what's happening, that sort of thing. But definitely water, the essentials should be mandatory to have this sort of planning if you are an attempted parent. We have about 5 minutes left before we conclude. 720-716-7300, decode 564-943-pound. *61, if you have comments, observations you need to make before we conclude. Did we miss anybody? Anybody comments to share before we wrap up?
I just want to thank the firefighter for what he said, because that's something I've had in mind since Katrina preparedness, but it's been taken for granted. So hopefully people have heard you loud and clear.
Indeed.
Yes, you know, because white people are always prepared. They're always prepared. I mean, we take it for granted. We see that pickup truck behind us where the wheels are so big that you can literally crawl underneath the vehicle. And it's a white guy or a white female driving the thing, you know, and, you know, during a case of a flood, it'd have to be some very high waters to bother them, you know, in that situation. And they make a hobby out of it. Just frequent to gun shops and army surplus shops. And white people are buying things off the shelf, and it's not even no quote-unquote season. That's something that they do, that they enjoy doing. Look at YouTube. And any weapon that exists that is everything except maybe a nuclear bomb, they are shooting it or blowing it up or something, you know, that sort of thing. So that's what they do. And we're going to have to basically prepare ourselves because ultimately we are the target in a lot of cases. We are the target.
Spoken like Charles S. Dutton in Menace to Society, indeed. Any other folks that we missed totally? Got everybody? Nothing. No additional comments. Folks need to make sure they get in for the week. Grand. We'll assume folks are satisfied. The metaphor we heard, I think it was Ivory who said they were talking about Katrina, said, oh man, y'all haven't buried that yet? I'm not actually sure that they did recover all the bodies from 2005. That was something that they talked about, not even being able to get an accurate count on exactly how many people did die in this event, much less recouping all of the bodies. So, no, we have not buried that yet. Anywho, check the Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook, social media outlets for upcoming programs. Get some white people on the program as we wrap up summer, head off into autumn. We missed a segment. It was supposed to be about flying and all of the dangers. I can only reiterate, I would not be flying this year. It would be all about if you can drive, train, no flying. It is way too dangerous. The reports just keep coming out about white people being drunk and disorderly, violent when they're out and about on these planes. So I just don't think it's worth the risk. In addition to, you know, you still got the COVID situation. And then if you travel and something happens, you end up testing positive and they don't allow you to fly. And they've canceled a lot of flights and weather situations. And it's just been, doesn't really seem like the best time to be planning globe-trotting trips and vacations and such. Try to take day trips, things that you can just drive, stay local, don't have to go too far, don't have to worry about some sort of catastrophe upending your vacation. Just saying. And for the end of the year, definitely no Halloween, Christmas, Thanksgiving, none of that. If you can't drive and meet up to do that, if you got to, let them know in advance. That is not worth it to risk flying this year for all of that. Way too dangerous. People normally act up during that time of year anyway, traveling and all that, because there's so many people flying and all the rest of it. Whew, can't even imagine this year. Anywho, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know it's so-called holiday weekend. They will have enforcement officers out those sobriety checkpoints if you're in the U.S., I would not be out, got to hit the bar to wrap up the summer and all the rest of it. No. Hunker down, stay inside. Plus, they got all those wild, like, COVID restrictions. I know they do here. Like, they had, hey, virus is spreading. You can't be out in big crowds and all that. Got to wear masks even outside. So I would hunker down. Not the time to do Labor Day celebrations either. If you are going out, be very alert. Say the names again. 22-year-old Peyton Hurd, child rapist Benjamin Eugene Dagley. Lots of dangerous whites out and about. You should be thinking these folks could be armed. If someone is being hostile and loud in public, exit. This is not a time for verbal confrontations. You don't know if the person's armed. You don't know if they have an armed entourage. If you didn't leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit. If you're driving, buckled up, being alert as possible, know what's going on around you. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling, no gossiping highest levels of black self-respect each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Super important. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Ashe.
Goodbye.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.